It's like if you have a big dog and he makes a mess in the house. You rub his nose in him and then work him over. That's what Kim G
do. You do what? We apologize to anyone out there who cares about their pets, which I would hope would be the vast preponderance of all of you.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me!
Delete! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Happy Cinco de Mayo. This is episode 598 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for a very rainy Sunday in New York, May 5th, 2019. I am the Solid Monster. Chris Jericho is returning to New Japan Pro Wrestling 2 weeks after his match with Kenny Omega at Double or Nothing to wrestle Okada for the IWGP Championship June 9th at their Dominion show in Osaka. So in the span of 2 weeks, Jericho gets to wrestle arguably the two best wrestlers in the world. That's a pretty good stretch there for him. Jericho and Omega, they both crashed the Southern Honor Wrestling Show on Friday night in Marietta, Georgia, to hype their upcoming match in Vegas. They had over 1,000 people, apparently, in the building on Friday night, and had a pretty wild brawl. Got the whole roster involved, videos up on YouTube. I was already thinking that Jericho was going to win on that first show in Vegas, you know, kind of even things up with Omega from their first match. And now I feel even more confident about that because I don't see him beating Okada. But Jericho Okada and Jericho Tanahashi are two of the last real big Jericho matches I think that he's got left in New Japan. It was only a matter of time. I didn't think they would go to it this soon. This announcement kind of came out of nowhere. But that match is set for the 9th, as is Ibushi and Naito in a rematch for the Intercontinental title. Again, that's on the Dominion show on June 9th. We have a ton of stuff to get into here this week. Just a ridiculous amount of things to get into this week. The WWE ratings collapse. Dean Ambrose, or Jon Moxley, I guess I should say. Leo Rush. Have a lot of news and thoughts on him. The Revival. We'll talk about Money in the Bank. We'll talk about Blood Money in the Bank coming up in about a month. The Von Erich documentary. A lot of stuff to get into, but before that, as you can tell, we are 2 weeks away from episode 600 of this show. Feels like just yesterday I was doing 500. And for episode 500, I went live on YouTube. And so we're going to do it again for episode 600. So mark the date down, Friday, May 17th at 9 p.m. Eastern. Audio only, no video. I'm not happy with this camera or the setup I have in here. So in due time, I'll start doing more video stuff again. People have been hounding me about that. But I will be live, doing Money in the Bank predictions, running down the card for Double or Nothing and doing predictions for that as well. That show falls on a busy weekend, so there'll be a lot to cover. And taking your phone calls, as we did for the last two live YouTube shows that I did. So we'll be taking phone calls from you guys as well. It's going to be a good time. There's no net with these shows. So if I have a coughing fit on the air, you'll get to hear it. Or if there's another house party outside like there was last Friday night, you'll get to hear that too. I want to bash my head against the wall, but you guys will get to hear that. And that'll be the show for that weekend. There will not be a Friday show and a Sunday show, just so you know. So I hope you can join live and call in. If not, the show will be archived on YouTube immediately after and pushed out to the feed as normal that Sunday. So again, May 17th, mark the date down for episode 600. Keep supporting the podcast via Audible. I appreciate the hell out of all of you who do. Use our link, audibletrial.com/solidmonster. They've been a great partner to us now for a very long time, and a lot of you guys have gotten a bunch of free books out of it. All you got to do is put the link in, sign up for the 30-day trial, and even if you cancel, you get to keep whatever free book you pick as part of your trial. And of course, you could always make a PayPal donation on thesolidmonster.com, right-hand side of the page, you will see the button. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Hopefully, I hear a lot of you guys on roll call for episode 600. We'll be immortalized on the live YouTube stream. But thank you to him. Also, thank you to John Luis Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Pull No Punches Alan Ragasa, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Malicious Intent Michael Cuomo, Stephen Handyman Halistick, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichert, kind of a big deal Corey Blake, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, Billy Hardcore Habibi, Poison Pill Lindsay Manns, Recon Russell Bulware, the Five Tool Player Adam Bartolo, Mentally Unstable Matt Cotter, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, and Kill Him With Kindness or Just Kill Him, Kerry Perry. I also want to say shout out here to Gerald Laddie, thank you for the iTunes love, and Christopher from Los Angeles who says, praise be to Solomonster. Thank you for watching Raw and SmackDown so I don't have to. Well, you got it, my friend. I got you covered. I was going to say my pleasure, but that isn't always the case. Shout out to Preston and his mother, Renee, who I know is going through some tough times right now. Hang in there. The monster is thinking about you. And James Travis, 8-Track Brown, in our Facebook group, he lost his grandmother to a senseless act of violence. It was actually on the news here in Brooklyn. It's a terrible thing that he and his family are going through right now. If you know him, if you've ever interacted with him on social media, give him a shout. Let him know that you're thinking about him, and hopefully they find the scum who did this. WWE has officially announced its return to Saudi Arabia Friday, June 7th at the King Abdullah Sports City Stadium in Jeddah. It will air live on the WWE Network as the other two specials did last year. No name yet for the event. Might I suggest the sequel to Sweet Saudi Money 2 Electric Boogaloo be Sweet Saudi Money 3D and make everybody in the audience wear those funny glasses? Or I think it was Brennan Williams who I saw call it this online. He's in NXT right now and he tweeted something out calling it the Greatest American Bash. That works too. The Greatest American Bash, live from Saudi Arabia. They're busting out the big guns for this one. Bill Goldberg is among the talent advertised so far. It doesn't explicitly say that he's having a match, but I don't think they're flying him all the way over there and paying him to give a lecture on Jewish ancestry. We've got Goldberg, Brock Lesnar, The Undertaker, Roman Reigns, Braun Strowman, Seth Rollins, AJ Styles, and Kofi Kingston are all announced so far. Mick Foley said that he can be had too, for a certain price. If they wanted a rematch of the Hell in a Cell with him and The Undertaker bad enough, and they were willing to pay for it, then they'd probably get it. Now, I didn't hear his comments, I only read them. I am sure that he was joking. I certainly hope he was joking when he said that. Because, forgetting the Saudi prince for a second, the idea of Mick Foley stepping back into the ring at all is something that absolutely nobody is asking for. He'd never be cleared anyway. If they cleared Mick Foley to wrestle and take bumps, but they forced Daniel Bryan into retirement for 3 years due to concussions, then the entire system is a sham. Plain and simple. As far as them going back to Saudi Arabia, look, it will never be a good look for WWE to do business with the Crown Prince. After he had that reporter killed, the Washington Post reporter. Killed and dismembered, I think it's important to note. But it probably doesn't help matters that Saudi Arabia just beheaded 37 people, including a kid who was set to attend college in Michigan. I don't know how many of you know that whole story. He was actually accepted 7 years ago, but he was arrested 7 years ago on his way to the airport to come to this country. His crime, apparently, was that he attended a pro-democracy rally. And he was among the 37 who was beheaded in the last few weeks. So that's the government that WWE has chosen to do business with. It's always important to make the distinction that it's not a reflection on the people there, but the government that they have chose to do business with. And look, that's their choice. But with that, they're going to have to take the heat. Every single time they announce a new show and they go to Saudi Arabia, and every time that there's something like this that is in the news, they are rightly going to take the heat for it. It's just sort of baked into the contract that they signed. No women among the names announced so far. No surprise there. I did say on Twitter, if they tell the Crown Prince that Becky Lynch is the man, then they might just let her wrestle on this show. Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns being on that list is very interesting, considering the... Now, I don't think he ever went public with this, but the reports at the time in the fall last year were that he did not want to go to the last Saudi Arabia show. He did not want to go to Crown Jewel in Riyadh, which, as it turned out, he didn't have to because of his leukemia diagnosis. So it never really got to that. But the rumors were, we already knew John Cena wasn't going to go. Daniel Bryan is not a fan of going to these shows. And interestingly, he's not advertised for this either. But that Roman was going to join them. And then, of course, he got sick. So we'll never know. But now he's on the list. This time he's advertised for it. Daniel Bryan, like I said, is not. Sami Zayn is not so far. Either he didn't want to go, or he was kept home for his own safety last time, supposedly because of his Syrian heritage. There's some tension there. Anybody who doesn't want to go to perform on the Saudi Arabia show should in no way be forced to go. No different than their trips to Iraq all those years ago. Rob Van Dam is one of the only people to speak up and say, I don't want to go to Iraq at the time, to what was at the time a full-blown war zone. And he got heat for it. He was never pushed at a top level again after that in that company, although that probably had more to do with his arrest the same year, because I think him turning down the invite to Iraq was a few months after he got popped, the whole pot bust, and they had him drop the WWE title and the ECW title. That probably had more to do with it than anything. But good for him. He doesn't owe anybody an explanation for why he doesn't want to go. That story always made me laugh. It's like, apparently, that's what got him heat. It was more than the fact that he didn't want to go, but that he didn't thank Vince McMahon for the opportunity when he was invited, and he didn't have a good enough reason for not going. Doesn't need one. If people don't want to go, they should not be forced to go. So we'll see if there's any noticeable faces missing this time from this show. Goldberg. Why is Goldberg going to Saudi Arabia? Well, they're paying him a shitload of money. That's the main reason. But he also responded to two Saudi Arabia fans on Twitter, Saudi Arabian fans on Twitter, with emojis when they tweeted him about how excited they were that he was coming to their country to perform in front of them. And again, as I said before, I mean, there are a number of WWE fans in Saudi Arabia. I have some listeners who actually live in Saudi Arabia. I had one listener, I think a year ago, tweet me a video, this 30-second video, of him driving in his car down the street somewhere in Saudi Arabia while listening to the podcast. And it was awesome. I love seeing stuff like that. But that's why Goldberg, at least on Twitter, that's why Goldberg claims he's doing it. He's doing it for the people. It's not the money. Of course not. He's doing it for the people. Now, there were rumors that AEW was either in talks with him or they were possibly interested in bringing him in so they can get that one really big name to help get them off the ground. And again, those were the rumors. I don't know if there were any discussions between the two sides. I know Batista talked to the AEW people. He's publicly admitted that. He said he had conversations with them and they made him a very generous offer, or he was led to believe that he would make some very good money. And in his mind, though, he had one match left in mind. That was the match with Triple H at WrestleMania, and that was it. He got his match, and now he's retired, and he's done with wrestling. But the AEW and Goldberg rumors have been around for a while. Obviously, they didn't get too deep into any talks. But I don't think it's a coincidence at all that all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Goldberg is back with WWE. What a coincidence. What a coincidence. There are no coincidences in wrestling. Let me just say that. But it's been over 2 years since his last match. Last we saw him, he lost the Universal title to Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania 33 in what I thought was a really fun match. It's just 5 or 6 minutes of these two big bulls beating the hell out of each other from the opening bell. You know, it wasn't 90 seconds like their Survivor Series match, but it was short enough. They didn't overstay their welcome, and it was actually one of the more enjoyable parts of WrestleMania that year. Now, do they go with a Goldberg-Lesnar rematch? Goldberg-Lesnar 4? You gotta change it up. I wouldn't go back to the same match again. Goldberg and Roman Reigns, that could be an attraction. Battle of the Spears. or Undertaker against Goldberg, which is a match that Goldberg has said in the past that he's wanted. You know, after watching Undertaker on that last Saudi show, I shudder at the thought of that match. But I guess it would be, I guess it would be an attraction. You could build it up on TV for a few weeks. You know the WWE would love to get a couple of Goldberg-Undertaker segments on these TV shows, the way their numbers keep dropping like a rock, even if it's only 2 weeks. So, you know, I could see them putting a match like that together. Or maybe WWE goes the predictable route and they don't announce any match for Goldberg other than he's going to be there. And he ends up doing some kind of segment where he interrupts Elias. And he gives Elias a spear and a jackhammer and he leaves. Could be something as simple as that. But we'll see what they have up their sleeve for him. Look, you could do a mega match or something. There's going to be a lot of people who aren't even going to bother with this show, who just don't watch any of the Saudi shows. And so I don't know what kind of audience they'll get for it. Supposedly there was a drop-off in network subscribers after the last show from people who said they were going to boycott and actually followed through. There was a noticeable, I don't know how big the drop was, but there was a drop, apparently, coming out of that Crown Jewel show around that time period that you could conceivably tie into the Saudi Arabia effect. Will they lose subscribers again for doing another show there? I don't know. I doubt they care for the money they're getting. They probably don't care. They figure they'll recoup those subscribers at some point. They're going to be relaunching the network later this year. They haven't explained what that means. I assume that's just the introduction of the different, you know, tiered system. Maybe that's when they're going to start offering, you know, other promotions like ICW and, you know, other promotions that they have a working relationship with. They may start introducing their shows onto the network for a higher price point. You know, but there's a network relaunch of some kind coming later this year, and I'm sure they're pretty focused on that right now. But it's, you know, it's that sweet Saudi money that's allowing WWE to throw around the kind of money they are to its talent right now. Jim Ross said in a recent interview that he heard WWE offered $500,000 to keep a mid-card performer who's not even on TV that much, to keep him in their stable. And then there's The Revival, who I'm going to talk about here in a little bit. But speaking of Brock Lesnar, ESPN reported this week that Brock Lesnar informed Dana White that he will not be returning to the UFC, and in fact, he is retired from mixed martial arts, which means there will be no fight with Daniel Cormier, there will be no fight with anybody for Brock Lesnar. And that is a huge bargaining chip that he loses if he closes the door on his MMA career. I am not buying this at all. If any of this sounds familiar, it's because we've heard this before. 4 years ago, he chose on ESPN, he went on ESPN and made the big announcement that he was choosing WWE over UFC. This was right before WrestleMania 31, and he said that he signed a new deal with Vince McMahon. I'm an entertainer, that's what I am, I'm not a fighter anymore, I'm leaving that behind, I'm closing the door on a return to MMA, is how he phrased it at that time. So, here we go again, rinse, repeat. He has played both sides against each other brilliantly for years now to get a better deal for himself. He's got no reason to close that door for good. He was being drug tested as recently as 2 weeks ago. I don't believe for a second that he is closing the door completely on another fight. Now, he may not actually ever fight again. Maybe he has no intention of fighting. But if he thinks that he can leverage a better deal for himself by unretiring and playing the two sides against each other, believe me, he'll do it in a heartbeat. In fact, in The Observer, it said that he pitched a flat fee to Dana White, as opposed to being paid on pay-per-view points if he was to come back to UFC, because their entire pay-per-view structure has changed now with their ESPN deal. Now they're going to be making the same amount of money no matter what, even as their pay-per-view numbers have continued to drop off in recent years. It's a hell of a deal for them. Brock didn't want that. He gave them a number. He said, this is the number I want to be paid. They thought that number was too high. And he decided to retire. Until the next time he decides to retire.
This is the 1840 Theater Hounslow. Calling next at Clapham Junction. Junction! Woman said, Junction! Please mind the gap, because it's massive, massive!
grape zero sugar. Now available in the UK by popular demand. Grab a bottle and make your mouth funner. Big up our soft drink massive. General leave it out of the Fanta crew.
Also, there was a report, and I believe it was attributed to Brad Shepard, I want to say, that supposedly Brock Lesnar has told Vince McMahon that he plans to retire from WWE as well, and he wants to do so at WrestleMania 36 next year in Tampa. I am not sure that I buy that either, because why the hell would he tell Vince McMahon that so far in advance? But let's play along. Let's play along and say that it's true. Who does Brock wrestle in his final match? Well, I know a guy. A guy who's made it his mission to be the man to retire Brock Lesnar. And his name is Matt Riddle. Who also happened to fight in UFC, by the way. 7 wins. Would have had more had they not overturned some of those wins due to pot failures. Brock Lesnar knows about drug test failures, although that was a very different kind of failure than the ones that knocked Riddle out of the UFC. But I think with enough time on the main roster, which of course is a huge risk in and of itself, I mean, you just look at this guy's name and Vince McMahon would probably put him in a fucking green question mark costume. But with enough time on the main roster to kind of build him up, and maybe there isn't enough time for this, I don't know. I mean, we're a year away from WrestleMania, but with enough time, I think that that could be one hell of a 6-minute match. And you can make a new star. Something the WWE doesn't seem to know how to do anymore. But that doesn't mean you don't try. But when Brock does decide to step away, I was thinking about this, and this would be a good question to pose to all of you. What is his legacy? What will people think of when they think about Brock Lesnar once he's gone, once he's officially retired? I think that they will think about a guy who wanted to make as much money as possible, who was a naturally gifted athlete, which he is, who did not get paid by the hour. He showed up, he did his job, and he went home. And a lot of people will hold that against him, and they shouldn't, because that is the deal he was able to negotiate for himself, because he knew his worth. And he was smart. It's like the people who knock Hulk, you can knock Hulk Hogan for a whole bunch of different things, but it's come out over the years. At least one of the contracts that he signed with WCW, it may have been the deal that he negotiated with them to kind of re-up in like 98. There were rumors he might jump ship and go back to WWE. He ended up staying with WCW, and maybe it was in a lawsuit, but a copy of the contract got leaked, and it was unbelievable. And I remember reading parts of it on the podcast at the time when it initially was kind of revealed. And it showed he was getting like 25% of like pay-per-view revenue, and all the things that he had built into this contract were just unbelievable. And people were attacking Hogan for it. And I just remember thinking, why are you attacking Hogan? Attack Bischoff. Attack WCW. They're the ones that agreed to it. Wouldn't you try to get as much as you could out of the company? All they had to say was no. But they obviously didn't want to lose him, so they gave him what he wanted. It's not Hogan's fault. That's him being smart. It's him being shrewd. You could say the same thing about Brock Lesnar. Vince McMahon doesn't have to keep signing him to these contracts. He doesn't have to agree to a part-time schedule. But he does. It's not Brock's fault. Brock's one of the smartest guys in wrestling, the fact that he's able to keep negotiating these deals. He's a Hall of Famer. We know that, but he's the kind of Hall of Famer who may or may not actually show up for his own induction, because he doesn't seem to care about that sort of thing. He sees wrestling as a business, as a means to an end, not as the end, like so many other people do. He represents something, physically anyway, that WWE does not have a lot of these days. Those sort of imposing, larger-than-life type stars. So when he does show up, he stands out so much more. You can say, oh, Brock's lazy, he's this, he doesn't do anything, he just stands there. But you can't deny the fact that when his music hits and he comes out there and he's bouncing up and down, there's just a different feeling. He's deceptively quick for a guy his size. He can bump around as good as any big guy I've ever seen. When Brock's got those, you know, working shoes on and he's bumping around for somebody, or he goes flying out over the top rope, you know, for a guy as big as he is, it's pretty damn impressive. He's one of the better kind of bump takers I've seen. in WWE. You wouldn't expect that for somebody like him. And when he is motivated to go out there with somebody he wants to work with, that's when we get to see the real Brock Lesnar. And it's a shame that we don't get to see more of that, you know, more of what he's capable of, wrestling-wise. But it's like Hogan in Japan. He knows what works for him and what he doesn't need to use. Here in this country, for example, you know, we saw a side of Hogan in Japan when you watch those Japanese matches that you never saw here in this country. Because he knew the audience, he knew what he can get away with here, and what he had to do when he was over there. There was a whole side of him that a lot of people just never got to see. And you could say the same thing about Brock Lesnar. I mean, I remember him putting Chris Benoit and people on SmackDown in the stretch muffler and all these different wrestling holds the first time around when he had his first run. He left that in the past. It's not like he forgot how to do it. He just left that behind. That was a different Brock Lesnar. And I wish we would have got to see more of that. Because I cringe when I hear people say, Brock Lesnar doesn't know how to wrestle. Brock Lesnar's not a good wrestler. All he does is suplex. Brock Lesnar won an NCAA title. You're going to say he doesn't know how to wrestle? Believe me, he's capable of a lot more than what he shows us. And it's hard to measure how much of a real box office attraction he is these days, given how a lot of the metrics are down in terms of ratings and live event attendance, but he doesn't show up on TV and he doesn't do live events. And their pay-per-view model is so different than it used to be, you can't judge his drawing power off pay-per-view buys anymore either. You can, I mean, maybe you can by network subscriptions. But how often does he wrestle there too? And frankly, network growth is not all that impressive. It's kind of flat right now. But I would say don't underestimate the appeal that he may have had and that Ronda Rousey for sure had on those Fox executives when they signed that new TV deal for SmackDown last year. So I don't know that I could sit here and say that Brock Lesnar has made the company more money than he has sucked out of it. But Lesnar will go down as one of the biggest stars they ever had. And I would say that I'll miss the guy after he's gone, but I never get to see him. So I don't know that I'll even notice. Dean Ambrose didn't wait very long after his contract with WWE expired to start making waves. Not long after midnight on May 1st, he posted a video on his Twitter account. I believe it's the Twitter that WWE forced him to set up all those years ago under his WWE name, which he never used. I think it was set up in 2012, and there were no tweets. He does not use social media, or at least up to now he never did. He never wanted to. But he had an account, he had the blue check mark and everything, and now it spells out the name John Moxley, which is the name he used on the independent scene before coming to WWE. The video shows him pacing back and forth in his cell, a jail cell, and he punches his way out through the wall. He climbs up over the wall, gets all cut up and bloody from the barbed wire. He's walking through the streets and the cops are looking for him, sirens in the background. He's wrapping the barbed wire around his arm. It's digging into his flesh and cutting him up. And this is all interspersed with clips of him shadow boxing in a gym somewhere and training in a gym. And it ends with the name Mox on the screen, which may be what he goes by now. Maybe instead of John Moxley, he'll just be Mox. He learned from Vince McMahon, you gotta cut that first name out. All the people getting their undies in a bunch about how it represents him breaking free from WWE, from the WWE prison. And oh, woe is me, you know, he made millions of dollars and became a big star. Whoa, like mocking the guy. Like, oh, he had it so hard making millions working for WWE. Hey, maybe it does represent that. Or maybe it just symbolizes Moxley breaking out of prison, the prison that he's been in since 2011, when he went silent and Dean Ambrose was born. Maybe it has more to do with the return of the Moxley persona than anything to do with bashing WWE. See, I just blew your mind. So there's more than one way to look at that. By the way, I don't think anybody is feeling sorry for Dean Ambrose that WWE ruined his career or held him down. The man was pushed as a top star for most of his run there. He was wrestling main eventers from his very first match. Multiple championships, pay-per-view main events, paid very good money, I'm sure. one of the most popular guys on the roster, even when he wasn't really being pushed that hard. He was still one of the most popular guys on the roster. He met his wife there. He got married. WWE was very good to Dean Ambrose. They were more good than bad to Dean Ambrose. But by all accounts, he was frustrated creatively. I mean, when the initial report broke from the Torch, PW Torch, and Wade Keller broke the news at the end of January, they had the scoop that Dean Ambrose was planning on leaving WWE when his contract was over at the end of April. They broke the initial story, and I believe it was in that initial story it mentioned that creatively, he was very frustrated. There were things he wanted to do, things he wanted to say, but he couldn't. He hated what his character had become. He felt it was way too hokey, which it was. Like, if you're an actor, and you played a hokey, goofy character in a film franchise, and you were worried about being typecast as that guy, but you made $3 million a picture, maybe that guy gets offered a more serious, sinister role in another movie as some supervillain, even if it's for less money. But he's bored, and, you know, with the other role, he's just bored to tears, and he wants to be challenged creatively to see if he could do it. He thinks, hey, maybe this would be more fun. Maybe the movie's a flop, but hey, fuck it, I can't do both, so I'm going to take a chance on myself with this other film. You know what, dude? More power to you. Go for it. Now, I'll admit that his character grew stale, very stale, a long time ago, and that heel turn was a complete disaster. I mean, that heel turn was just an epic fail. Totally botched. Money is clearly not this guy's primary motivation, because he's probably made enough and he's probably saved enough to where when his contract was coming due, he was able to look them in the eye and say, thanks, but no thanks. I respect that. I'm sure they offered him stupid money to stay in that company and keep the shield intact for another 5 reunions. And he said no. Seth Rollins tried to talk him out of it. He said no. Roman Reigns tried to talk him out of it. He said no. It wasn't about the money. And he never bitched about anything publicly. He stayed off of social media. He put his head down. He went to work. He jobbed to EC3. He jobbed to Bobby Lashley. He jobbed to Drew McIntyre. He tried to put these guys over on his way out. Whoever they wanted him to put over, like a good little soldier, he put them over. He was looking up at the lights an awful lot these last few months. He was kept completely off the WrestleMania card. He went to work, he did his job, and he waited patiently for his contract to expire because he knew he only had a few months left on his deal, and he was going to be free. No tweets saying that, oh, I just asked for my release. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but nope, nothing from him. Radio silent, no notes on Twitter or Instagram or cryptic photos, cryptic tweets. He waited for his contract to run out. So I don't know where some people are putting this guy down as though he's stupid or he's committed some kind of a sin. He went about things, I think, in as professional a manner as can be expected. Now he's free to do and say whatever the hell he wants and sign, if he wants to, with whoever he wants, under his own terms. I never saw him asking for anyone's pity. You know, these same people who would say these kind of things probably think, oh, what an idiot. Turned down millions of dollars to go hardcore wrestle or whatever they think he plans to do. The man can do what he wants. And one day he's going to be back in WWE. Not a doubt in my mind about that. And they'll throw in even more money. Even though money may not be the most important thing to him, they'll do whatever it takes to get this guy back. Because they can't make new stars. And they'll want him that much more. Maybe he'll be a bigger star when he comes back. Maybe he'll feel like a bigger deal. We've seen guys leave or get released and go away and come back. And at least initially, they feel like a bigger deal. It happened with Alberto Del Rio when he came back. I didn't care about Del Rio, but he left. He was everywhere. He even wrestled a little bit in Ring of Honor. AAA, Lucha Underground, he was all over the place. So when he came back, it felt like a bigger deal. He actually had a buzz around him, even though they started to kill it on his first night in. Even though he won the U.S. title from John Cena, what'd they do? They brought him back with Zeb Coulter. It's To this day, when Dutch Mantel will give interviews, and he's asked about that, and there's no great answer. It's not like there's some great mystery behind Vince McMahon's creative vision. He says himself, to this day, he cannot figure out why they put the two of them together. They just put the two of them together to be different. It was like oil and water. They didn't go together. Of course, it flopped. And it didn't take more than a few weeks to, you know, the buzz was gone from Del Rio. He was just another guy, another cog in the machine. But, you know, for a while there, he had a buzz around him when he left and came back, and Drew McIntyre, and you could probably find a few other people like that. Maybe that's Ambrose in a year, or in 3 years, or however long it is before he comes back, because he will be back. But with this one video, more people have talked about Dean Ambrose than they have in months. And now the speculation begins. Is he going to All Elite Wrestling? I do think he's going to end up there. And there were some signs people pointed out, if you paid attention, possible Easter eggs in this video. You know, the shot of the dice on the wall for the Viper Club, which is a real nightclub in West Hollywood. The dice, double or nothing. Hey, it's in Vegas. That had to have been done intentionally, whether he's actually going there or not. Maybe he's just kind of fucking around with people. Apparently there were also marks on the wall of his prison cell, almost like he was counting down the days to busting out. And people with more of an eagle eye than I have pointed out that if you count out the lines of the marks on the wall, they equal 25. And Double or Nothing, of course, takes place on May 25th. Could mean nothing. But these things were not put there by accident. Supposedly, he is going to be working multiple independent dates starting next month. That does not stop him from wrestling for AEW. It only means he wouldn't be exclusive to them. And look, if he does go to AEW, the question then becomes, do you save a name like him as a surprise for the pay-per-view this month? Or do you save him for that first live show on TV, whatever network they end up on, in the fall? That would really be the only question. He would be fresh off WWE television if you had him show up in Vegas. But that, of course, is up to Ambrose. I saw Jimmy Havoc. Jimmy Havoc has wrestled death matches his whole career. He signed with All Elite Wrestling earlier this year. And he was the first AEW guy to tease wanting a match with Moxley after that video came out. But he also tweeted, "Give me Moxley," back on January 30th. When the news first broke that Ambrose was going to be leaving WWE, so he wants the match. Now, you can't talk about Ambrose without talking about the It's a Work Brigade. It's a work! Which is still out in full force, by the way. Oh, the video production was so slick, it looked so professional-looking, they say, that it must have been produced by WWE. Because nobody else in the world can produce a good-looking promo video, apparently. Only WWE, they have a patent on the technology for clean production videos. It's all just the work, they say. It's all part of the work. Yes, Vince McMahon, the same man who everyone says is so out of touch and such a control freak when it comes to his own characters and his own personalities, is going to spend months having his announcers talk about how this guy is leaving when his contract is up. As though Joe Blow, watching on TV, who doesn't go to wrestling news websites and listen to podcasts, even knows when that date is that his contract is up. But the internet says it's May 1st, so let's drag this out until May 1st. We'll have a million final Shield fist bumps. And then we'll re-debut him under a new name that most people aren't familiar with, save for some indie fans who saw him break light tubes over his head 10 years ago. Kill all of the equity that we've built up in this Dean Ambrose guy over the last 7 years. To have him come back as The Mox. To do what exactly? The same damn thing he's been doing for years? What exactly would be new about this character if he came right back to WWE, but under a new name? What, are you suddenly going to be wrestling barbed wire matches on TV? I'm seriously concerned about the mental state of some of these people. These are the same people who think Elvis is still alive, that Roman Reigns faked his leukemia, and that Chris Benoit was framed for murder. Like he's fucking Roger Rabbit.
This is the 1848 to Hounslow. Calling next at Clapham Junction. Junction! Woman said, Junction! Please mind the gap, because it's massive, massive! Incredible Fanta! We got the new flavor! This and
brought to you by the new Fanta Grape Zero Sugar. Now available in the UK by popular demand. Grab a bottle and make your mouth funner. Big up our soft drink massive. Just don't leave it out of the Fanta crew.
Fightful.com broke the news this week that Scott Dawson and Dash Wilder of The Revival were each offered $500,000 a year for 5 years to stay with WWE. That's $2.5 million devoted to each member, $5 million total, to keep The Revival under contract for the next 5 years. Bodyslam.net claims that dollar figure was actually low, and each member was actually offered $550,000 a year. Boy, that must be the scariest t-shirt company in the world for WWE to be so desperately throwing that kind of money around at people to stay. Bodyslam.net also broke the news that WWE has informed Dash Wilder that they are extending his contract by 2 months to make up for the time he was out injured with a fractured jaw 2 years ago when The Revival were first called down to the main roster. And it would not at all surprise me. You watch in these next few weeks if this news comes out. It would not at all surprise me if they turn around and do the exact same thing with Scott Dawson, who missed about 4 months, I think it was. Double the time that Dash missed. 4 months he was out with a ruptured bicep. When Dash came back, he got hurt. And that's how much time he missed. You watch them tack that onto his contract too. Now, per The Observer, they turned down those $550,000 a year offers after meeting with management before Raw on Monday. They were going to huddle and meet with, I don't know, Vince directly or other people, other executives in the company. And supposedly they said no. They rejected the offer, which is obvious given how they were booked later on the show that night. They shot an angle where the Usos caught Dash and Dawson in the showers with Dash shaving Scott Dawson's back hair. And they mocked them for it. And really, this comes down to the ultimate decision of money versus happiness, right? It's the age-old question, what's more important to you? What's more important? Is it more important that you be happy with what you do and satisfied and not miserable, but maybe make less money? Or is money the most important thing? Is money the end-all be-all? Make as much as you can. And if that means you've got to eat shit for a while, then so be it. It's the ultimate money versus happiness decision. Me? Look, it would be very hard to turn down that kind of money. But until you are in that situation yourself, you just don't know. All these people quarterbacking off this story, oh, you know that if it were you, you would take that money in a heartbeat. Every situation is different. There's a lot of other factors to take into consideration. You know, how much do they want to be on the road traveling for the next 5 years? Are they comfortable with the schedule they have now? Do they want more time off built into their deal? And remember, they're also responsible for paying all of that travel each year, except for airfare. The company takes care of that. But they have to take care of everything else on their own. Are they okay with that? How much of that is going to eat away at what they're making? Do they want 5 more years of Vince McMahon's creative decisions? Are there teams outside of WWE that they want to work with and feel they can make money with? On the flip side, this is not a business where you have a 401k waiting for you on the other end when you turn 65. There's no pension plan. It's what you make now and more importantly, what you save. The more you make now, the more you can bank it, invest it, grow it. So you've got a little nest egg for you and your family when your career is over. And you're always one injury away from your career being over. You're always one horrible injury away from WWE going to you and saying, we're not going to clear you. You got to remember that too. And a team like The Revival, getting that kind of money, hey, the landscape may be very different next year, especially if AEW falters and doesn't do well. The landscape a year from now could look very different. So there's a lot of factors to think about here. It's not such a cut and dry, easy decision to make. To me, it's the 5 years. 5 years is a long time. And I know that Kevin Owens and some other people in recent, the last year or so, have signed 5-year deals with WWE. And that's great. Kevin Owens, I'm sure, is making, you know, a nice living for himself, and he's got 2 kids and a wife to support. But 5 years to me, that's a long time. If it was 2 years, if it was 3 years, to me it would be a no-brainer. 5 years, though, I mean, why would they sign five-year contracts now when they still have a year left on their current ones? AEW hasn't even had their first show yet. The Fox deal and all that Fox money hasn't even kicked in yet. It would be foolish to commit to a deal that long before all of that happens. You know, I think you push for a shorter deal, and if they want them bad enough, they'll agree to it. They'll agree to 3 years instead of five or something like that. If not, then you'll know it's not a matter of them valuing you for your talent or what you bring to the table. They just want to sign you to keep you from going somewhere else, which is really all any of this is about. WWE is cash rich at the moment. They can throw that kind of money around like it's nothing. No skin off their back, but they have all the leverage. It's always about WWE having the upper hand. But to sign for 5 years when you still have a year left does not seem like the wisest choice to make. And it looks like they feel the same way. And in case you're not already excited by this back hair storyline, here's the write-up on WWE.com for Raw tomorrow night. Okay, the headline is, "You Shave My Back." This is what it says. It says, okay, so the headline shouldn't have been that the Revival shave each other's backs in the shower, but the mildly embarrassing footage obtained by the Usos was still enough to unman the top guys when all was said and done. The Usos now have a psychological edge. Do they? They have a psychological edge in this young rivalry, and in order to catch up to their rivals, could have used a different word there, but that's okay. The former Raw Tag Team Champions have to either develop thicker skin or finish out their business between the ropes in a way that they could not this past week against Zack Ryder and Curt Hawkins. In other words, this could be the beginning of a whole new revival or the first humiliation of many. The choice is up to them. The choice is up to them. If that isn't a not-so-subtle way of sending a message, I don't know what is. It's almost like Vince wrote that write-up himself and gave it off to the web team and said, here, post this, pal. They need to make the decision they feel is best for them and their families. They have to make a decision that they can look in the mirror and be happy about. And all these people calling them stupid for turning... I said this with Ambrose before. All of these people, and I see people saying... it would be dumb for them to turn down that kind of money. Who the hell are these guys? They're never going to get another offer like this for the rest of their lives. And calling them basically stupid for turning down the money. You people need to wise up and realize that it's not always about the freaking money. I would rather make a little less money and be able to go to work happy and like what I do rather than make a lot of money but be miserable and want to blow my brains out every time I wake up in the morning. There's a lot of WWE guys over the years, not even top stars necessarily, but high up enough on the card, who have done interviews talking about how they have this nice big house. Oh yeah, I was able to finally buy my dream home. You know, I bought this nice house, but I only get home a few days a month to really enjoy it. What's the point in making a lot of money and spending it on things like that if you're never able to really enjoy it? Or if you have a kid like Dawson does, and have to miss out on a lot of them as they're growing up. Just keep that in mind before you go off on how dumb they are or anybody else is for just not taking the money and keeping their mouth shut. Lio Rush. This Lio Rush story is pretty crazy. Lio Rush is no longer with Bobby Lashley. There's no storyline explanation for why. He just simply has not appeared with him for the last 2 weeks. He's also been pulled from the upcoming European tour. All of this... after Fightful.com reported that he has heat backstage with, obviously, the wrong people. A PW Insider then expanded on this, saying that there has even been talk of moving him back to NXT. Is that supposed to be some sort of punishment? I guess pay-wise it would be a demotion, but I would be elated to be back in NXT. If they really wanted to punish him, they'd keep him on Raw. Or move him back to 205 Live. But they also said that his heat goes back to November of last year, and the European tour, his first European tour with the company, where he blew off a tradition for rookie members of the roster where you stand at the gorilla position backstage and you hand water out to the wrestlers as they come back through the curtain, and you carry drinks and coolers to the hotel where everybody is staying. Not unlike the sort of things that you would, like, Young Lions would do in New Japan, although those guys do a lot more than that. I mean, you know, I remember there was a, it was like a documentary or something I watched on maybe it was New Japan World, but, you know, those guys cook, they clean, they do laundry for the people at the dojo over there, for the veterans. Then they go on excursion. Leo Rush may soon be sent on excursion to Orlando, Florida. Yeah, the water thing, it reminded me, though, and I've seen a lot of other people point this out. This was only a few months ago. The whole water thing reminded me of a story that Aleister Black told on Facebook last year after Roman Reigns was diagnosed with leukemia. And when Black was first doing live events with the Raw brand 2 years ago, this is long before he debuted on the main roster, he would make sure that the dressing rooms were clean because sometimes the guys would leave and the dressing room looked like a freaking disaster area. There'd be, you know, litter on the floor and it would just be a mess. And so he would clean the dressing rooms after the wrestlers were gone. And he would make sure that they had water after their matches. And he described it as stuff that was forgotten by a lot of people. But he felt it was important because it keeps you humble and it teaches you respect. And Roman Reigns later on pulled him aside and said, listen, dude, I don't want you cleaning the locker rooms anymore. You're one of us. You've been doing this long enough now to you know what you need to know. Just relax. He told Aleister to just relax. So this is nothing new. Leo Rush is hardly some kind of exception. But I guess this was his first tour, and he did not do any of that. And not only did he disregard it, and he disregarded the advice of some of the veterans on the roster who said he was making a mistake, but he then went and complained to management about it. He snitched on him. Fightful said that there were also issues with him bringing uninvited guests to the locker room. His wife, for example. His wife would sit in on rehearsals. And again, when people would try to give him advice, Finn Balor was said to be one of those people. And I don't think in any of his tweets or the interview that he gave to Fightful that Leo denied. I mean, he said that he and Finn are cool, but I don't think he outright denied that this happened. But Finn Balor was said to be one of the people who tried to just give him some advice, you know, just to stop the guy from putting the gun to his head, so to speak. And he blew him off. He blew these people off. So Leo went on Twitter to defend himself. And this is just some of what he had to say. He said, heat is such a subjective term. Do I stand up for myself when life challenges me? Yes. Do I have opinions and not just blindly follow? Yes. Am I best friends with every single superstar? No. But I do work hard. He says, many spouses and family members come to shows and are welcome backstage. Our schedules are not just Raw. We have 3 live shows a week, travel days, pay-per-views. My wife came to share my WrestleMania moment with me, as did many families of the WWE stars. The little time that a professional wrestler can spend with the family is rare and precious. I conduct myself professionally and respectfully, and so does my wife. And on the European tour stuff, he said, I believe we are all able to carry our own gear and provisions. I treat others as equals, and as a young Black male, have often had to fight for my own equality. And then, I guess, feeling like he had to set the record straight, because his name was just being dragged through the mud, he did something that no other WWE star, I don't believe on the record anyway, has ever done, because they're really not supposed to do this. He went and spoke to Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful on the record. And WWE typically does not allow its talents to give interviews like this to wrestling websites or podcasts, and especially not about something like this. But he went and he talked to Sean. Here are the key things that he had to say coming out of this interview. He said, my issue is not with my on-screen role. He had nothing but praise for Bobby Lashley. He said, my issue is that I have not been on meet and greets with Bobby. I have not been getting paid for merchandise for us that has my catchphrase on them. I have been sent to live shows and TVs and forced to pay my own rental 5 days as well as hotel while not making enough money to do so. Walking around broke in the biggest sports entertainment industry that there is while having 2 kids and a wife to support. Now, I checked WWE Shop out of curiosity. The only merch, the only shirt that Lashley has that would have any kind of catchphrase on it is the one that says the Almighty on the front. And on the back, it's got Lashley's name written three times. From when Leo would be at ringside trying to get the crowd to chant, Lashley, Lashley. That's the only thing that's there. And my guess is that maybe he's not getting any royalties because it's a bad shirt and nobody's buying it. Maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. But on the main roster rookie stuff from the European tour, this is what he said. He said, it's not about race, it never has been, but public perception is important to me, and when we have fans that travel all over the globe and watch us get off buses and into hotels, the look of a black kid carrying waters and bags for other wrestlers is just not a good look, especially when I'm trying to portray myself as a superstar as well. Me and Finn are cool, and my wife has never been an issue. There is someone who works for WWE who has hated me since the day I worked for Ring of Honor, and now that they work for WWE, they're leaking false information to get me released. At a certain point, I have to defend myself, so that's what I decided to do. We're all human, and we're all grown-ass adults. This kind of shit that flies backstage is ridiculous, and I'm surprised more people are not speaking up. So that's from Leo Rush. And interestingly enough, again, he does not deny the stuff about the water and the getting all, you know, carrying the coolers and all that stuff. So clearly there is a lot of truth to these reports. You know, and Fightful, and Sean's a great reporter. Mike Johnson of PW Insider, he's another reliable guy. This is not made up, manufactured bullshit if it's being reported. I wouldn't be talking about it and giving it credence on my show if I thought that it was some, you know, dingbat on some third-rate website just making shit up. And again, interestingly enough, Leo did not deny a lot of this stuff. So I believe that a lot of this did happen, as it was reported. And that's what he had to say on the record. Now, who this mystery person is, who he thinks is trying to get him fired, and why they would want to see him fired, that he didn't say. And I'm not going to sit here and speculate and look, who was on the Ring of Honor roster when Leo Rush was? Everybody trying to figure that out. He never said that this person was in Ring of Honor with him. All he said was that there was somebody going back to when he was in Ring of Honor who didn't like him and had it out for him for some reason. That doesn't necessarily mean this person was also working for Ring of Honor. So I'm not going to sit here and speculate on who it might be because I don't know who it is. If that's even true, he has it in his head that somebody's out to get him. Now, it would be a really bad look for WWE to discipline him right now or fire him, which they're not going to do, because he went out and did this interview and because he is complaining about this stuff. But this is the sort of thing that if, you know, normally this would get somebody fired. It's rare that a WWE talent goes public with comments like that. A WWE contracted talent goes public with comments like the ones he made here. And I actually think it's refreshing in a way. And I wish more of them felt like they had the freedom to speak up when they see things going on that should not be happening. Now, Mike Johnson, after that interview ran, he posted a long follow-up with some more information here. And he posted an update to say that one WWE talent who was on that European tour with him contacted the website to point out that while Leo blew off things like, you know, the water stuff and all that, Drake Maverick and AOPP, also, who were on their first tour, they did not blow that stuff off. They did all of that stuff. And they wondered if the reason that Leo did not feel comfortable doing the same thing is not so much because, well, you know, he thinks it's a bad look for somebody like him, but maybe it was because he brought his wife on the tour with him. Maybe he would have felt embarrassed for her to see him doing that kind of stuff on the tour. Johnson says there were multiple complaints made about Leo Rush bringing his wife backstage and having her change in the women's locker room. There was an incident apparently where he brought a group of people backstage at a TV taping, and when the group was stopped for not having proper credentials to get in, they started yelling at a female member of the WWE security team. And that did not exactly ingratiate Leo to the roster any more than he already was. During that tour, one of the veterans, and this would not have been Finn Balor, this would have been somebody else, tried to talk to Leo and give him some advice, Rush told the person, "I work for Vince, not you." And that person was then, a little while later, they were pulled aside by a member of WWE management because Leo had gone to management to complain that this person had tried to give him advice, had tried to tell him what to do, and this person wasn't an executive. He wasn't his boss. That was the great sin that this person committed. And it was after that, supposedly, that Leo was kicked out of the locker room for a time, which is something he does deny. Mark Henry is said to be a big fan of Leo Rush. He has tried to help him behind the scenes. Mark's like a big brother now to some people. He's like the locker room enforcer. He even said that part of his deal now with WWE, he's not at every, I don't think he's at every single show, but part of his job is to kind of enforce sort of a code of conduct in a way in the locker room and kind of be that guy that I don't know that there is anymore. I used to hear stories about Undertaker being that guy, and a lot of those guys aren't around anymore. And so Mark Henry spoke out. He was on Busted Open Radio. He makes regular appearances on there. And he pulled Leo aside. He said the last time he saw him, and he said, "Look, I'm hearing stuff in the locker room, dude. What's going on? What's wrong?" And Leo told him to his face, "Nothing is wrong." And Henry was just angry because he feels that Leo lied to his face. And he also took exception to the stuff that Leo told Fightful about not doing the tasks that rookie members of the roster would normally be expected to do. You know, Mark said that when I started in WWE in 1996, I was helping Yokozuna. Yokozuna was my responsibility as the rookie. That was my job. And Henry said, "It's not a race issue. It's an ego issue." He said, "Who are you? Nobody is exempt from being respectful to the business and paying homage to the guys drawing money. We've all done it. Steve Austin did it. The Rock did it. Are you better than The Rock? Get the hell out of here." Man, Henry was pissed. You just read his comments. You don't even have to listen. You just read those comments, and you can tell he was really angry with what Leo Rush said. Now, he also went off on Rush acting like he's destitute working for WWE. He said, "If you can't pay for a rental car and you can't pay for a hotel, with all the money you're making every week, you need to change the way that you're spending. You can't blame that on the office. If you spent everything before you got it, that is your problem." This is after PW Insider was told that Leo Rush was offered a new 5-year contract. Of course, there's that number again, 5 years. He was offered a 5-year deal, said to be in the $300,000 per year range, but he turned it down. And not only did he say no, he countered it by saying, "I want double." He wanted $600,000 a year for 5 years. And therein lies the problem. Therein lies the problem with WWE offering these overinflated salaries to people to keep them from leaving and from going somewhere else. This is the problem with offering two guys like Dash and Dawson, all due respect to them, who have hardly been positioned as important members of the roster. That's the problem with allegedly offering them $550,000 apiece per year to stay. The problem is that when you do that, who's to say that somebody as talented as Leo Rush doesn't deserve that or more? Part of me wants to sit here and just say, who does this guy think he is? He's been on TV for a cup of coffee, he barely wrestles, and he thinks he's worth $600,000 a year? But you know what? Why wouldn't he be? If guys in a similar position are being offered the same kind of money, you know, Leo's a very talented guy. I don't think any of these people are worth $600,000 a year. If we're being honest, I don't think any of these guys are worth that kind of money. I think all of these numbers are a fucking joke. It's like Monopoly money at this point. But that's the problem that you create for yourself when word gets out that you're offering that type of money to talents lower down on the card. Just imagine the kind of money they must have offered Dean Ambrose before he left. You know, Booker T on his radio show chimed in. He said, "Sometimes you start believing in your own press clippings. I hope he can get the heat off him because he's very talented." Leo, he said, "Get your game right." Chris Jericho, he had a different point of view. He responded to a fan on Twitter. It said, "You're not a big star in WWE, so you don't know the respect and dedication that you need to make it there." I never once made a young guy carry my bags, but I was shown respect every day. To disrespect the vets in any way is taboo in our business. Everybody's had an opinion on this story. Here's my two cents. And I don't say this as a wrestler. I'm not like Booker T or Mark Henry or Chris Jericho. And I don't say this as a young black male like Leo Rush is. Although I don't think this is a... And he said it himself in the interview. It's not really a race issue. And Mark Henry said the same thing. It's not about that. There were stories about Leo Rush that predated his coming to WWE. Stories that concerned his attitude or his opinion of himself. And look, it's fine to be confident. But the issue I have with Leo Rush here is less about him not wanting to carry water for people, although handing water out to wrestlers as they walk back through the curtain does not seem like a big deal to me. It's a respect thing, I get that. All that other nonsense, though, about carrying other people's bags for them, I know that stuff happens in other sports, too. That's not something that is exclusive to the wrestling business. You know, here, carry my bags, rookie. Fuck off. Fuck off with that nonsense. I've got my own bags to carry. I'm not carrying somebody else's bags. They have two arms. They can carry their own bags. If I see a little old lady in the street who needs help carrying her bags, I will help her carry her bags. A 300-pound bodybuilder can carry his own bags. So there is a point where I think that stuff goes too far, and it just gets silly. Especially in a professional environment. This is not the WWF locker room in the 1980s. This is 2019. They are a publicly traded company. They have sponsors and stockholders and all of that fun stuff. And some of the things that would fly 20, 30 years ago should not necessarily fly today. But even if you think that all of that stuff is silly and unnecessary, a little bit of humility goes a long way. And from the sounds of it, he has rubbed a lot of people the wrong way because of the way that he has conducted himself with some of the other wrestlers. And whether it's Finn Balor or whoever this other person was that he complained to management about, when you have people trying to help you, trying to give you advice, and they're not being mean or malicious about it, and your response is, in so many words, basically, to say, fuck off, you're not the boss of me, and then complain to your boss about it, that doesn't make you some kind of a hero, that makes you an asshole. If that's what happened. And that's always the challenge with these stories, right? There's always three sides. There's Leo's side, there's the side of the other wrestlers, and then there's the truth, which lies somewhere in the middle. If Leo Rush can prove that he is being shortchanged or screwed out of royalties on merch that belongs to him, then he should absolutely speak up about that. And if he is claiming poverty because he's not making enough after road expenses and paying for health insurance for he and his family out of his own pocket, then he should absolutely speak up about that. Because they're obviously not letting people out of their contracts so easily these days. So if this guy really is struggling to support his family, it's not like he can just up and walk out. They're not going to let him. So he has every right, if that's happening, to speak up about that. But where I have no sympathy for him are these stories about him blowing off veterans who are just trying to help him. Or inviting people backstage who have no business being there and they're being obnoxious. You're not a rock star. You don't need an entourage. If I pulled that at my job, people wouldn't like me very much either. He's no different. It seems like there is an immaturity there. Or was. I mean, immaturity, that was, you think back to the tweet, right, that got him into hot water. Was it last year, I guess, when Emma got released? And he made that stupid tweet. He's lucky he didn't lose his job over that. I never thought he should. He got a second chance. Maybe that immaturity is still there. I don't know him enough to say, but he has clearly managed to piss off enough people for some reason. And that is not going to bode well for his future in that company. You know, he talks in this interview about this one guy who is trying to get me fired and leak stories, and he's out to get me. But there's multiple people telling Johnson and Fightful and these different sites. It's not one person who is sharing this story about Leo Rush. There are multiple people who are saying this, who have an issue with this guy, the way he conducts himself, the things he said, the things he's done. It's not some conspiracy by one person behind the scenes who's out for vengeance. And so maybe that's part of the problem. Maybe there is still an immaturity there that You know, he's rubbing people the wrong way because of the way he's carrying himself. Look, this guy is super talented. I think he can be an asset for them. Handing bottles or cups of water out to the other wrestlers when they come back from their matches is not a hill that I would choose to die on. But if those other issues he brought up were true, then speak up. But don't be a dick to people who are only trying to save you from fucking up your own career. Raw last Monday was live from Lexington, Kentucky. We had our Twitter poll, over 2,700 votes, just 17% thumbs up, 83% thumbs down. The Raw and SmackDown ratings are in total freefall right now. Both shows set non-holiday record lows this week, and you cannot explain this away by talent absences. That ain't gonna fly. 2.1 million total viewers for Raw. SmackDown had 1.8 million total viewers, its lowest mark since the brand split 3 years ago. And there are people who are knowledgeable about the TV industry who will say that total audience doesn't matter. TV executives that, you know, the networks, they only pay attention to the demos. They don't even look at the total audience. That's what they'll say. Well, let's take a look at those demos then, shall we? Because we have that information here as well. For Raw, the 12 to 17 demo, down. 35 to 49 demo, down over 28% this week. 50 plus demo, down over 5%. Let's take a look at SmackDown. 12 to 17 demo, down 24% from the week before. 18 to 34 demo, that's an important one, right? Down 33% from the week before. 35 to 49 demo, down 17%. This is bad news, no matter which way you slice it. And you know, somebody asked me, this was last week or 2 weeks ago, maybe it was, is Monday Night Raw the worst show on television? And I can't call it the worst show on television because I don't watch all of the shows on television, but I know there are some pretty god-awful shows out there. And I looked at the MTV schedule the other day, because every time I think about bad TV, the initials MTV pop up into my head. And so I went to the MTV schedule, and literally, from morning to night, during the week, look at what we have here. Catfish, 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 Teen Mom 2, 16 and Pregnant, Catfish, Catfish, Catfish. The next day, Jersey Shore, Jersey Shore, Double Shot at Love with DJ Pauly and Vinny. Then there's this show called Ridiculousness. Ridiculousness, Ridiculousness, over and over again. Here are some descriptions I pulled from this show. Model and actress Charlotte McKinney joins Rob Sterling and Chanel to tell some dirty secrets, taste some all-natural beef, and clench for the category Spike My Butt. Then there's this one. Eric Andre returns to check out some power dicks. Watch people go tongue to tongue in the category unexpected mouthmates and get sticky with his favorite dressing. Sticky dicks and tongues. Thank you, I will pass. But of all the shows I watch on television, and there aren't very many right now that are kind of in my rotation, so I'll include all the shows going back even 5 years that I've watched. Monday Night Raw is by far the worst out of all of them. Which is to say, it is on my list of shows that I watch, and that I do sometimes enjoy. But of those shows, it is down at the very bottom of the list. And you could tell that they are in panic mode right now, because they're working an angle on social media where Roman Reigns, who has just moved over to the SmackDown brand, right? SmackDown's biggest acquisition of all time. Roman Reigns is now saying that he plans to return to Monday Night Raw tomorrow night. He's going to make an appearance. Well, that didn't last very long. WWE then issued a statement saying that we understand that Roman Reigns has expressed an interest in showing up on Monday Night Raw tomorrow night, and we want you all to know that he will not be appearing on Monday Night Raw because he has SmackDown obligations. Well, no, he doesn't. Not anymore. SmackDown Live event had a live show scheduled in Kentucky. That just got pushed back to October. So the big dog is free and clear to show up tomorrow night. They're obviously worried about the NBA. But Roman hardly helped the SmackDown ratings since being moved over. So I'm not quite sure how much they think he's going to help the Raw numbers. I don't know why they think there's going to be some kind of a big spike in interest to see Roman Reigns when nobody gave a shit when he was on SmackDown. All of a sudden they're going to care that he's on Raw? Brand split be damned. On this show last Monday, Alexa Bliss introduced the Raw members of the men's and women's Money in the Bank matches. I will talk about who they are later when I do a quick rundown of the card as it stands. The show was really built around and ended with a contract signing for Money in the Bank with Seth Rollins and AJ Styles. And they were sure teasing that AJ might go heel, and he even attacked Rollins at the end of the segment, although I didn't see it as a heel turn. Some people thought that that was him turning heel. I didn't look at it that way at all. You know, Loose Cannon Lopez, shout out to him. He pointed out something very interesting. It looks like the Universal title, the tomato title as I call it, no longer has button snaps on it. Instead, it has a Velcro closure, like you would find on one of those toy belts, the foam belts. So unless it was just a bad angle, and he is mistaken, it sure does look like the belt now has Velcro instead of button snaps, which is just an observation. I'm not going to pass judgment either way. I mean, look, this company's got far bigger problems than whether or not the belt is held together by fucking Velcro or snaps. I just thought it was an interesting observation. Anderson and Gallows have been moved over to the Raw brand. And per PW Insider, there has been no change in their contract status, which means that as of now, they're out of the company come September, unless they get hurt. Boy, they better wrap themselves in bubble wrap or else they're going to tack on months to their contract. Supposedly, they may have been offered deals similar to the ones offered to the Revival, and they too have turned it down. They want out. they are ready to cut ties and break free. And so, as of now, they're still gone as of September, and that's why it makes it hard for me to believe that they are going to, for example, be aligned with AJ Styles for a club reunion, which I absolutely would love to see them do, and I think they should do. But would they put those guys on TV every single week in prime position with one of the top stars on the brand, if not somebody who could come out of Money in the Bank even as the champion of the brand? I don't see it. Not if they're not going to sign a new deal. So all these people getting excited about a possible club reunion, I'd love to see it, but I just don't see how it's possible. And then they lost to the Usos. After the match is when they did the angle showing Jimmy and Jay eavesdropping on Dash and Dawson. And, you know, Dawson was getting his back shaved in the shower by Dash Wilder. Riveting. Riveting television here. Bobby Lashley was the guest on Miz TV that led to a match between the two of them. Lashley beat Miz with an assist from Shane McMahon, who made a rare Raw appearance. Shane McMahon is such a ratings draw, they decided to have him feud with two people on two different shows. This ended with Shane trapping Miz in a submission hold until he passed out. I don't know, from boredom or pain or what it was. They're going to have their cage match at Money in the Bank. Sami Zayn came out for another promo, shitting on the fans. Good as he is at it. I do enjoy these Sami Zayn promos. Mark Henry even said that Sami Zayn, in his opinion, is the best promo in the company right now. He is loving this new Sami Zayn. And I can't find anybody, you know, on the active roster. I mean, Samoa Joe is great, but how often do we get to... it's not like he's coming out every week cutting long promos like Sami is. So I'd put him on the same level with Sami. It's hard to find anybody else who's as good or better than him right now on that main roster. The thing with him, though, is he needs somebody to feud with, because coming out every week on TV and just shitting on the fans is already getting a little long in the tooth, and he needs to actually engage with somebody. I know one person he was supposed to feud with coming out of WrestleMania, Luke Harper. But they changed their mind and left Luke Harper with nothing. The update on Luke Harper in the Observer this week made me, I think, angrier than anything I read or saw this week. And I know it shouldn't. I know it's not my career. I know it's not my situation. It's not my life. But it still made my blood boil when I read this update. Vince McMahon, in writing, told Harper that he was not going to release him from his contract, which with the added time that they've tacked onto it, the 6 months they've added, is not up until WrestleMania time next year. And that's fine. That's not even the big news. We already knew that as far as them denying his release request. That's not even what made me so angry. The reason they dropped their plans for him, okay, and the plan was for him to feud with Sami Zayn coming out of WrestleMania. And I'm not sure if Zayn would have been a babyface or if Harper would have been the babyface. I don't know. But the reason they dropped their plans for him is because Vince McMahon says he doesn't get Luke Harper. And he complained of all the things to complain about. He complained that he can't even do a Southern accent. This is apparently a complaint that Vince McMahon originally had 4 years ago. He has still not gotten over this. He mentioned it again to people behind the scenes. He cannot do a Southern accent. I don't get him. Because that's what Vince McMahon thinks all Southerners are. A bunch of hillbilly-looking people with big bushy beards. I don't see Rowan doing a Southern accent. And last I checked, they brought him back to manage the WWE champion. But he doesn't get Luke Harper. Harper was pitching ideas on a regular basis, supposedly, for his character while he was out. He wasn't just sitting on his ass. He was pitching idea after idea, and they turned down every single one of them. This guy is trying to do their job for them. An army of writers can't come up with anything for this guy. He's trying to come up with ideas for himself, and they rejected them all. I would love to know how bad they must have been that they rejected them. He was supposed to start working with Sammy the day after WrestleMania, and then he was informed that he was not needed for TV, so that he went home. Then they called him back that Tuesday to come in for a dark match against EC3, which was the night they did the trial run with Drake Maverick in EC3's corner as his manager, a pairing that I have been pitching for them to do since EC3 signed to come back to WWE. For a company that loves its sports entertainment, I was highly sports entertained by the two of those guys together in TNA. That was back when I was watching TNA on a regular basis. I enjoyed them. I enjoyed their act. I thought it could work here too, if given the chance. I was encouraged when I saw the news that they had paired them up, even though it was a dark match. I said, well, there's a step in the right direction. This is good. This is good. And I was immediately discouraged when I read that Vince watched the match and hated all of the manager spots that they did. So it looks like that pairing is now dead before it even had a chance to begin. Then, the day of the Superstar Shakeup, somebody asked, hey, which brand is Luke Harper going to? And Vince said, the guy can't even do a Southern accent. He had a bad match with EC3. So they didn't put him with either brand. And it was then that he asked for his release. He saw the writing on the wall, and he asked for his release. And they denied it. You want a Southern accent? Here's a Southern accent. Fuck you! There's your Southern accent. The man gets hurt. The man heals up. He comes back. He's waiting to get back into the thick of things. Put me in, coach. He's pitching ideas left and right to try to help his cause. He's under the impression, I'm going to start back the day after WrestleMania with a brand new program, and then he gets told, don't bother to come to work. Doesn't even get drafted. They don't even think enough of the guy to draft him to one brand or the other. He has to be let go. And not only is he told no, he has 6 months tacked onto his contract for time missed. If you don't think much of this guy, if you think so little of him, why keep him? If you think that lowly of him, he certainly can't be of value to anyone else, why keep him? Because you're scared. That's why. Fear. That's the only reason. You can't come up with an idea for a 6'5" guy that looks like he does. I mean, hell, the comparisons are already there looks-wise. Just make him your own Bruiser Brody. He named his son Brody. I don't know if he named his son after Bruiser, but these comparisons have been out there for years, and I don't know if he's modeled himself after him. He certainly has talked in interviews about how he, you know, grew up having a lot of respect for Bruiser Brody. Make him your own. A wild man. As wild as somebody can be on a PG show. But there you go. There's one idea. But they give up on you. They give up on one person gives up on you. And once that happens, you're dead. You are dead in the water. 39 years old, and this guy is dead in the water. But we're going to keep you around for another year because we can. Even though I don't get why we even signed you in the first place. But we'll keep you around in case we need you for another dark match. Bray Wyatt tweeted that he's working on trying to get Luke Harper into his Firefly Funhouse. Good luck with that. Their boss belongs in a nut house. That's where he belongs. Why is this man at 73 years old still running creative for this company? Can somebody answer this question for me? It would be like the chairman of General Motors who worked his way up through the company. He started his career working on the assembly line, even though he runs the company now, and he's 20 or 30 years older and he's ancient. He's still running the assembly line. Why? If these last few years prove anything, if these television numbers prove anything, step aside for the sake of your own company. Step aside and give somebody else a chance. Stop being so damn selfish and give somebody else a chance. We had Rey Mysterio. Now I'm all fired up here. Yeah, it's funny. I have people tell me, oh, you got to calm down. It's not that serious. It's entertainment. You shouldn't worry about it. I do. Not a child anymore who puts the TV on and watches the fun little wrestling show and turns it off and then goes about my business. You get older. Social media, the internet is what it is. You learn about these things. You go to the news websites. You listen to other podcasts. You hear about what's going on. And it just, if you care enough, you can't not help but be pissed off by some of these things that you hear, because some of these things don't have to be happening. You know, it's not like they don't have the talent and they don't have the bodies. I'm not saying Luke Harper is the crown jewel in the company and is going to be world champion one day. That's not what I'm fucking saying. That's the other argument that I absolutely cannot stand. Why are you getting so upset about Luke Harper? He's a nobody. He's a mid-carder. Who cares? That's exactly the wrong attitude to have when you hear stories about this. Luke Harper is not the only victim of this. You think Luke Harper is the only one who Vince McMahon, he didn't get one bad appearance or something, or something as stupid as he couldn't do an accent, and he blows him off? You know how many other people have probably been affected by this sort of thing? But this is the person who is running the creative end of that company. He can run every end he wants to. He's the chairman. He's the owner. He's a very smart guy. He's a businessman. Let him run all the other aspects of the company. Let him run his football league. He does not have to be the driving creative force anymore in 2019 for this company. You know, and Sami Zayn in his promo, part of his gimmick here is, well, he said this on Monday night. He said, you know, people tell me that I should just quit WWE if I don't like it. He goes, and that would be great. But he goes, you know, I'm not going to do that because I am going to stay and I'm going to hold all of you fans accountable. Well, you know what? I'll do the same thing. You want to look at it like that? Somebody's got to hold them accountable. Somebody's got to tell these stories. Somebody's got to talk about this stuff. I'll do my part. Because it's just, it's absolutely insane to think that somebody at his age and his position, you know, running a multi-billion dollar company, still feels the need to just micromanage and be so involved in every aspect of the company when it comes to creative. It just blows my mind. I mean, nobody can tell him what to do. It's his company. Nobody can just force him out, I suppose. But for the good of his company, if he really cared and if he really gave a shit, he wouldn't shuffle new writers in and out. He wouldn't just shake up the rosters like a fucking snow globe. He would step aside and let somebody else's creative vision come to the fore. What do you have to lose? What do you have to lose? If numbers go even lower and things are not working out, you just revert back to the way things were and you take the reins back. But he is so goddamn selfish, he cannot do it. He cannot bring himself to step aside and give somebody, whether it's Triple H or whoever, to step aside and give somebody else a chance. Because he's selfish. And he is crippling his own product. And Luke Harper is just one little example of a much larger problem that's going on in this company right now, and is part of the reason why the numbers are going down and not going up. The buck stops with one person. Thy name is Vince. Ray and Dominic, Ray and Joe, had a match. Dominic, his son, was there. Ray won. He pinned Samoa Joe, and it was comical when the match was over. We saw, and Dominic is just, he towers over his father. And he got Ray up on his shoulders. It looked like Ray was his kid. It was actually, it got a chuckle out of me at the end of this match. Becky Lynch, she came out for a promo yet again, was interrupted by Lacey Evans. You know, if Becky is Batman, then she's missing her Joker in Ronda Rousey. Just hasn't quite been the same since WrestleMania. But you know what? Say what you want to, and a lot of people have been about her losing momentum, and just there's something missing there when she comes out and her promos. She still gets cheered in the buildings anyway, more than almost anybody else on that entire show. And maybe that doesn't mean much when it comes to, you know, tickets or ratings. Although merch, apparently she's still one of the top merch sellers in the company. But she still gets big reactions when she comes out. So it's not as though people have just stopped caring about her. But there's definitely something missing since WrestleMania. The two of them ended up in a pull-apart brawl. At one point, Becky was being restrained and she shouted over at Lacey. She told Lacey to go make me a sandwich. And later on Twitter, Lacey responded and told her that she's been making sandwiches and raising babies, meaning she's been raising her babies, raising her kids, but that is not how Twitter took that comment. Twitter is a very dark place, as you all know. And so they took it a different way, and that led me to the Urban Dictionary. And every time I am led to the Urban Dictionary, nothing good comes out of this. So I went to the Urban Dictionary to find out what a raisin baby is, because I had no idea. And suffice it to say, I will not be repeating that definition here on this show. I also did not know what a Cleveland steamer was until John Cena mentioned it in a rap that he did on The Rock years ago. So as PG as this company is supposed to be, I have been more scarred by them than anything I have seen in any horror movie. I mean, I watch this show. I watch Raw every week, so ain't nothing scarier than that. We had the latest Bray Wyatt Firefly Funhouse, one of the only reasons to even watch this show anymore. We saw Bray painting a portrait of some kind of, well, we found out later what the painting was, but he was sporting a red beret on his head, and he was like French Bray here. And by the way, the puppet is Abby the Witch. I'm still convinced that he said Penny in that first promo, but there's no doubt now that it is Abby the Witch and not Penny the Witch. We also have a rabbit puppet, which I guess we should have expected, because if you look at the Firefly Funhouse logo, it has the Abby the Witch character in it. It's got the other one? It's Abby the Witch and the Buzzard, and there was a rabbit. So I guess we should have expected there would be a rabbit at some point. Ramblin' Rabbit. I don't know if that's some kind of hat tip to the old Bray Wyatt promos, which many people would complain were just rambling on and on. But we got Ramblin' Rabbit. And he shows Ramblin' Rabbit his painting, which is of a shack in the middle of the woods burning up in flames, which is clearly his memory of Randy Orton setting Bray's shack on fire during their feud, which was supposedly the resting place for Sister Abigail. In the painting, if you look closely, in the window, there is a person who I assume is supposed to be Abigail. I don't know why there was a sombrero hanging on the wall of the funhouse. Maybe he plans to murder the entire Lucha House party. The word of the day was sociopath, which explains a lot about what we're seeing here with this character. Defined as a person with a personality disorder manifesting itself in extreme antisocial attitudes and behavior and a lack of conscience. There were no hate and heel gloves on his hands this week, but before the segment ended, when Bray told us that all we have to do is let him in, the way he said it and the look that he gave was sinister. He's trying to corrupt your kids. And Abby is the one pulling all the strings. That's what I think is going on here. By the way, I made the comparison last week to Candle Cove from that first season of Channel Zero. And a lot of you agreed with me, but some of you mentioned this YouTube series I had never heard of called Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared. Which I had never heard of it before. And I had so many people tell me about it. So I watched it. And that was pretty freaky. I enjoyed it. Of the five that I watched, I thought the kitchen one was the most disturbing. I don't want to give away why, but if you saw it, you can probably figure out why I would pick that one. So again, this has quickly become the one segment on Raw every week that I find myself looking forward to. So if we only get a few more of them, and then he just ends up coming back as his old self, I'm going to be very disappointed. SmackDown Live from Columbus, Ohio, Twitter poll, over 2,000 votes, 38% thumbs up, 62% thumbs down. Those are Raw numbers right there. Not good. What is good is that Daniel Bryan has been medically cleared. So I guess they never had to turn Kevin Owens in the first place, although I'm glad they did. But that was great news to read in the Observer this week. Daniel Bryan, whatever his ailment was, concussion or something else, whatever it was, he has been medically cleared and he could be back as early as TV this week. And he is scheduled to be on the upcoming European tour. I absolutely hated the opening history lesson in the ring with Michael Cole and Kofi Kingston. It's been a month since he won the WWE title at WrestleMania. And 75% of this segment was Cole showing us highlights of Kofi's journey. Kofi at the Elimination Chamber, Kofi in the Gauntlet, Kofi winning the championship at WrestleMania, and then the crowd with the You Deserve It chant. My God, shut up already. Enough. You deserve it. Shut up. We get it. Yes, he deserves it. He got his championship. Enough. That was a month ago. You would think it was the night after WrestleMania. The man was betrayed the week before, and you would never know it until the very end of the segment when Cole finally decided to bring it up. I hate when they do segments like this. But finally, Kofi, he gives Owens his championship match at Money in the Bank. He says, all you had to do is ask me. You didn't have to do what you did. Owens comes out and accepts. It wasn't until the end of the show that we got to see Kofi get serious and go after Kevin Owens with you know, great anger and furious vengeance. He went after him like a man who had just betrayed him a week earlier. That's the Kofi Kingston on this episode that we needed to see. I'm not saying he has to be angry every single week, because that goes against what his character is all about. But if somebody fucked me over, I'd be pretty pissed off about it when I come out the very next week. And at the very end, at least, we got that. Now, Kofi gave an interview to TalkSport.com. And he in part wanted to address the criticism, or they asked him anyway, about the criticism that he has gotten lately from people like Billy Graham, who I know I said that I wasn't going to even mention him again, but since his name came up, since I just mentioned it, this is the same Billy Graham who last week in a new blog suggested that Big E might be a racist. He was a racist towards Billy because he snubbed the superstar when Triple H invited Graham to a SmackDown taping some time ago. I don't know when this was. To cut promos backstage for the WWE Network. And Big E, in his mind, Big E snubbed him, and he wonders if that was because he's a racist. For Billy Graham to go after one of the New Day members as being racist, now that's rich. That's fucking rich. But anyway, Kofi was addressing his comments, and he was addressing comments made by Jim Ross, who on his podcast said that Kofi needs to show a more serious side. And that hopping around carefree and smiling does not fit with being a champion when you are a marked man. It may be fun for the children, but not for the older fans. And he said whoever is producing Kofi behind the scenes needs to help him with that. Well, here's Kofi's take on all of these legends trying to give him advice. He says, the New Day has been the New Day because of what we've done. We can be entertaining, but then we can be serious too. I think it's awesome that after all these years, guys like JR and superstar Billy Graham can still be fans. Superstar Billy Graham is almost like super fan Billy Graham right now. Everyone has the right to have their opinion. They are not talking to me. They are talking about me, as they should, because I'm the champ. So I welcome all criticism and opinions. I think it's great. For me personally, I'm going to continue to do what I have been doing in the ring. I didn't need their help or advice getting to this point, and I certainly don't need it now to tell me how I should be the champion. He's right. He's right. He is the champion. He got to be the champion by being who he is, not who other people wanted him to be. It would be like when Dean Ambrose went on the Stone Cold podcast and Austin just embarrassed him on live TV by criticizing the kind of champion that he was being on TV. It was completely out of line, I thought, for Austin to put him on the spot like that. I still feel that way. And not to, if he felt that way, pull him aside, you know, before the show or after the show and tell him. And I can absolutely understand why Ambrose would have been upset about that. Kofi is the champion. He does not need advice from superstar Billy Graham to get there because he's already there. But I do think it's a good thing to not be too one-dimensional. You know, we got to see angry Kofi by the end of the show, which was good. I do think that you want to avoid being too one-dimensional as a character. So what I'm saying is not that Kofi should just, you know, to what JR said, he just should change to where he's just more serious because now he's the champ, he's a marked man, there's going to be all these people coming after him, so he needs to just be more serious. I'm all for more serious characters, but I totally agree with what Kofi is saying here. And I think in this case, the New Day is what it is, right? The New Day has been around for 5 years. They've sold a shit ton of merchandise. They still, you might be sick of them, but they're still very popular. Kofi would not be the champion right now had he never become a member of the New Day. It all led him to this place. The New Day, it's all about the power of positivity, and to change that would change everything that they're about. What I mean, though, when I say that you want to make sure you're not too one-dimensional is that when there is a reason for you to be more serious, you have to be more serious. You can't have somebody do what Kevin Owens did the week before, and the very first time that we see you, when you walk out on television 7 days later, you're chucking pancakes into the crowd. You can chuck pancakes into the crowd 2 weeks later, but the week after something like that happens, or if somebody had put Xavier in a hospital bed, Kofi Kingston should not be coming out chucking pancakes into the crowd. He should have come out in the opening segment the way he came out in the final closing segment. That would be my only criticism. But what he's saying here is absolutely true. He's right. He got to be the champion by being the likable, smiley, positive underdog that people could root for and want to get behind. And so he really should not depart too much from that. I see what JR was saying, but I could also see why Kofi, in his mind, would be like, look, I didn't need your help to get here, and I sure as shit don't need your help now. And he's not wrong. Becky Lynch beat Bayley in a good match with the disarmer. Bayley has now lost to Charlotte and Becky since coming to SmackDown, which is not, yeah, look, I mean, those are not bad people to lose to, but she does need some wins under her belt soon. I think if she comes out and loses to Liv Morgan on TV this week, then we've got a problem. Charlotte came out when the match was over, booted Becky out of the ring, threw Bayley shoulder first into the post. The Hardys came to the ring to relinquish the SmackDown Tag Team titles due to Jeff Hardy's knee injury. He was on crutches. He suffered the injury at a live event the week before, even though they're crediting Lars Sullivan for the injury. He has already had surgery. He said on social media that he is going to be out 6 to 9 months. They never did get to defend the tag team titles, not even once. Lars Sullivan did come out. He gave Matt Hardy the freak accident and was threatening Jeff when R-Truth came out. Hit Lars from behind with a chair. If you'll notice, Lars never touched Jeff. Jeff was in the corner with the crutch. He had the crutch up. He was ready to strike and use it as a weapon when Truth came and hit Lars from behind. And we never saw Jeff again until Lars left the ring. And as he's walking out, as he is exiting, there you see Jeff Hardy laying on the ground face down. Now, you see, some websites called this a botch, but the way I look at it, Jeff's a veteran, he's a smart guy, he was just playing dead so that Lars would walk off and leave him alone. He knew that on one leg he would not be able to hobble to the back fast enough without Lars looking up and seeing him and coming after him, so he decided to play dead instead. That's the sign of a veteran wrestler right there. Why does it have to be a botch? That can be easily explained. Now, of course, I don't expect the announcers to think on their feet like that, or the people in the back to feed them something like that, to actually explain that to the audience, which of course they never did. But at least I can try to make sense out of these things, right? I know that's at least part of why you listen to me. I try to make sense out of this shit. I try. Believe me, I do. But it is smart, I think, to use the Hardys to get heat on Lars. They, as I said, they attributed the knee injury to him, even though when you watch the replay, when he originally laid out Matt and Jeff, he did nothing to Jeff's knee, but whatever. But I look at this tag team division, especially now that the Hardys are out, and my God, is this tag team division in just complete shambles right now. Not that it was all that strong before, but now the Hardys are gone. Big E is still out hurt, so the New Day is out of the tag team division for at least another month or so. The Usos are gone. Gallows and Anderson are gone. Not that they were doing much with them to begin with. And so that leaves us on the SmackDown side with Rusev and Nakamura, Heavy Machinery, the B-Team, and the Colognes. It's like SmackDown looked at the Raw tag team division over the last 6 months and said, "Hold my beer." I wish they would just merge both sets of tag team titles together and have teams float the way that Becky does right now. But they're not going to do that. In fact, they've already announced that Shane McMahon will be on SmackDown this Tuesday to crown new tag team champions. So he's not going to announce his plans to crown new champions, but to actually crown new champions. The way it's written, you would think he's going to hand them over in a briefcase or something, a la Triple H all those years ago. But I guess by the time SmackDown is over on Tuesday, well, you know what, it's pointless to even say, because they'll probably rewrite the frickin' script and change their plans 5 million times before we even get to Tuesday. But the way this is written, it sure sounds like we're going to have new champs on the show this week. We had a segment backstage with Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville. This is before they found out who the participants would be in the Women's Money in the Bank match. And Mandy's telling her, "I found out that, you know, we could be in the Money in the Bank match, but the bad news is that it's only one of us. Only one of us can be in the match." And Mandy is playing it up like, "Well, you know, I think it should be you because, you know, you're such a good friend," and blah, blah, blah. And Sonya goes, "Look, I know what you're trying to do here. You're trying to butter me up so that I turn around and I say, no, no, Mandy, you should be the one." She said, "But you know what? I think you should be the one." She goes, "You came this close to beating Asuka and winning the SmackDown Women's Championship once before." She says, "I think it should be you. You know, good luck." What a great friend Sonya Deville is. Now, I'm a wrestling fan, and so I have been conditioned in my 30-plus years of wrestling fandom to expect that Sonya Deville is going to fuck Mandy Rose over either this week or in the Money in the Bank match. And so I fully expect that something like that will happen. But for one night anyway, this woman was just, you know, being a good friend. She was the ultimate babyface, which can only mean bad things are coming. We had more interplay between Roman Reigns and Shane McMahon, and Roman had to overcome the B-Team in a handicap. Oh, the horror! He had to beat the B-Team in a handicap match, which of course he did. We had Randy Orton and Andrade Cien Almas teaming up against Finn Balor and Mustafa Ali. And it was a pleasant surprise to see that Ali got the win. Ali actually hit the 450 on Andrade and got the win for his team. Orton hit the RKO after the match on Balor, and it was Ali who made the save and sent Randy Orton out of the ring. And now this week, I think it's supposed to be Mustafa Ali. I believe he's facing Andrade in a one-on-one match this week. Interesting to note that, unless I'm completely wrong about this, that I think Ali used the 450 splash on TV this week and not the 054 that he uses sometimes. And on Raw, Ricochet, instead of his usual 630, I believe he won his match with a shooting star press. I believe. It's been a long week. Maybe I'm conflating this with something else. But interesting to note that, because I don't know if that means both moves, I don't want to say they're banned, but, you know, are these going to be the moves that they use going forward? Were they told not to use the 630 and the 054? They are kind of dangerous to watch. And Ali did hurt Daniel Bryan. Thankfully, it wasn't anything serious when he hit the move on him a few months back. And every time Ricochet hits the 630, I just think this guy's poor neck. But I don't know. Maybe it's just a one-week aberration. I guess we'll find out. And still no Buddy Murphy on this show. I'm waiting for Buddy Murphy to make his debut, you know, As much as I've enjoyed seeing Ali mix it up with these guys on the main roster, Buddy Murphy is the other one who I've talked about before as having great main roster potential. Just so long as he can do a southern accent, I guess. Let's talk about the updated Money in the Bank lineup here as it stands. Do predictions in 2 weeks on episode 600. But as of now, this is how the card looks. Seth Rollins and AJ Styles for the Universal Championship. Kofi Kingston and Kevin Owens for the WWE title. Becky Lynch defends her Raw Women's title against Lacey Evans and her SmackDown Women's title against Charlotte Flair. Roman Reigns takes on Elias. The Miz battles Shane McMahon inside of a steel cage. And then we have the two Money in the Bank ladder matches. On the men's side, we have from Raw, Braun Strowman, Drew McIntyre, Baron Corbin, and Ricochet. The same Ricochet who lost to Robert Roode the week before. The same Robert Roode who wasn't even on the show this week, let alone in the Money in the Bank match. And I don't doubt that Ricochet is a better fit for a match like this. If you said to me, there's one spot left, Solomonster, who do you put in the Money in the Bank ladder match, Ricochet or Bobby Roode? I'm going to pick Ricochet. But boy, it would sure be nice to know what the kayfabe reason is for including Ricochet and not Roode. No Cesaro or Rey Mysterio, as that graphic that was circulating on the internet last week showed. Tell me this would not have been a better match if you just swap out Corbin for Cesaro. Okay, if you say that it's better off this way, you're a liar. On the SmackDown side, for the men, we have Randy Orton, Finn Balor, Andrade Cien Almas, and Mustafa Ali. Pretty good lineup there. Pretty good lineup. Strowman, Orton, and Corbin should be out of consideration for winning, since they've already won. I mean, I know we've had some double winners before, but they should not be winning again. Ricochet and Ali, they're just going to kill themselves in this match, but I think it's either McIntyre or Almas for the win. I would go with Almas, but I could see Drew winning and then cashing in later in the night to win the Universal title so that we don't get a decisive winner between Seth Rollins and AJ Styles. For the women's Money in the Bank match on the Raw side, we have Alexa Bliss, who won last year's match. We have Natalya, Naomi, who at least won her last three matches on TV, and Dana Brooke, the apparent replacement for Sasha Banks, who refuses to come back to work. Dana Brooke, who could not win a match on TV to save her life, although she did pin Ruby Riott on main event 2 weeks ago. Poor Ruby Riott. They break up her group, and now she's jobbing to Dana Brooke on main event and getting passed over for a spot in the Money in the Bank match. What the hell did she do to deserve this? Sasha Banks is going to be watching from her couch, it looks like. You know full well that if she sits out for much longer, they're just going to tack those months on to the end of her contract and keep her from leaving, just like they're doing with Luke Harper. So either she comes back soon or this is going to get real messy real soon. On the SmackDown side, the ladies include Bayley, Ember Moon, Mandy Rose, and Carmella. Alexa and Carmella are both former winners. I take them out of the equation. I like Mandy for this. I like Mandy for this. I said that last week. And, you know, the people who think that Mandy Rose is terrible and can't wrestle, she really is not bad at all. And I like Sonya even more. You know, the two of them were probably, not even probably, I think they could have benefited from more time in NXT. They were called up too quickly, but I don't have an issue with Mandy or Sonya. They seem to be improving, and character-wise, you know, Mandy is fine. And I mean, I would love to see Ember Moon is another one who I wouldn't mind seeing pick up a win here in this match, but I could see Mandy winning the briefcase if she doesn't get screwed over by Sonya, which I still think is probably going to happen. And maybe the briefcase, yeah, that she's carrying around every single week creates some kind of tension between them. And maybe that is what leads to the eventual breakup. But we'll see what happens in the next 2 weeks. Again, these are not final predictions or anything. We'll do predictions when we get closer. But I like Mandy for this right now.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
Next NXT TakeOver show, which will be the first one that does not piggyback off of a WWE pay-per-view that same weekend, was originally scheduled for Saturday, June 8th in San Jose, California, with the announcement of the Saudi Arabia show taking place the day before, that date has now been scrapped, and instead TakeOver will take place 1 week earlier on Saturday, June 1st, from a location to be announced by Triple H on Monday. So by the time many of you listen to this, we will already know where the next TakeOver show will be taking place. There is an update on the NXT Tag Team title situation with the War Viking Experience Raiders, but it includes some spoilers for the upcoming NXT TV show, so I'm going to save that for the end of my NXT review. Killian Dane, who was part of Sanity and was promoted to SmackDown when Sanity was, and they proceeded to do absolutely nothing with him, has been moved back down to the NXT brand, or will shortly be moved back down to the NXT brand, which is for the better because clearly he was going nowhere on the main roster, especially now that Sanity has been split up, and so he's back in NXT. Tyler Breeze, I don't know if it's a permanent move or not, but he has been working some of the NXT live events, and he was also at the TV tapings this week, so he may well be back as well as part of the NXT roster, which, again, I think is a great move. At least he'll be used in some kind of a meaningful role there, at least. By the way, they have a new intro video and new music for NXT, which I like. They're using the song All Out Life by Slipknot as their new intro. The Forgotten Sons beat Danny Burch, Oney Lorcan, and Humberto Carrillo in the opening match. Carrillo went for a tope. Riker, Jackson Riker, that is, shoved his partner out of the way, and Carrillo nailed Oney. Nailed Oney Lorcan instead by accident. And Danny Burch was left all by his lonesome inside with all three Sons of Anarchy. Carrillo back in. Riker has both of them. He's holding both men in a, I guess, almost like a the position that you would hold somebody in if you were going to give them a scorpion death drop, right? Or a slop drop. And so he's holding both these guys for Steve Cutler and Wesley Blake to come off the top rope with a double foot stomp, or come off the middle rope with double foot stomps to each man, to no reaction from the crowd. And Riker ended up pinning Burch. So they're all in on the Forgotten Sons here. I don't particularly care for the act, but that's who they're trying to push right now. Kathy Kelly caught up with Shayna Baszler and her horse ladies outside of Full Sail. Shayna looked like something out of that new HBO show Chernobyl. The way that she was glowing. She was glowing so much here in this segment. This was spray tan city here. Holy shit. By the way, I am looking forward to that new Chernobyl show. If you know the story, it's obviously based on a true story, although maybe they take liberties on the TV show, but it is based on just a horrific true story. Depressing as all hell, but I watch Raw every week, so I'm used to it. I am looking forward to watching that. Dominic Dijakovic beat Mansoor. Mansoor was one of the four Saudi Arabian prospects, or not prospects really, but recruits, who did that segment with the Daivari brothers at the Greatest Royal Rumble last year. He is the first ever Saudi-born signee in WWE, although he's been living in this country since he was a kid. He started training 5 years ago, or maybe it was not 5 years ago. He started training a few years ago out in California. He was impressive here. He was outsized by Dijak, but you know, Dijak, in his last match that we saw him in here in NXT, he won in something like 5 seconds. This was a lot more competitive than I expected it to be. Feast your eyes for the win. After the match, two women wheeled out the Velveteen Dream. They wheeled him out on stage on a couch, and he sang his own version of the Star Spangled Banner with his own lyrics. This plays off the promo that Dijak cut a few weeks ago about his parents immigrating to this country and giving him the chance to be an NXT star, and so therefore he wanted a shot at the North American Championship. Dream has been on a roll with his matches of late, so him and Dijak should be really good when they do that match. I assume that's going to be at the next TakeOver. It was then time for the NXT debut of Kushida. Cool entrance, wearing pretty much the same gear he wore in New Japan, right down to the Marty McFly vest and Back to the Future glasses. He seems so happy to be there. When you listen to him or you read his comments and interviews, like, it's a dream come true. So pure. So innocent. We'll revisit this in a year and see if he still feels the same way. I suspect he won't feel so rosy. Look, I hate to be Debbie Downer, but you all know I'm right. interesting choice of opponent for him in Cassius Ohno, who's sort of the gatekeeper now for all of the new guys. He puts them all over. But he's also a lot bigger than Kushida, so some of Kushida's offense looked a little bit off. And I think, you know, some of that had to do with the size difference, and some of it probably had to do with the fact that Ohno dropped a knee on his face at one point that connected a little too well and gave Kushida a bloody nose, hopefully not a broken nose. Reminded me of Kevin Owens in his debut match at TakeOver against CJ Parker, when Parker gave him a palm thrust that broke his nose. Kushida fought from underneath for a good part of this. They wanted to show that he could withstand a lot of punishment and fight his way back, which he did. He won by submission with the hoverboard lock. A good debut for Kushida, but it leaves me wondering what his ceiling is in NXT, and I'm not even thinking about the main roster for this guy, because that's just not even worth thinking about. I don't see him as NXT champion. You know, North American champion, I could see. Him and Velveteen Dream at some point could be an interesting match, but I do wonder what his ceiling is here. I said earlier I had a spoiler note on the NXT tag team titles, so skip ahead a couple of minutes if you don't want to know anything. At the tapings on Thursday, the War Viking Raider Experience came out to vacate the NXT tag team titles since nobody can beat them. That brought out the Street Profits, who challenged them, and William Regal made the match. They had a match later on in the show, which ended in a DQ after interference from the Forgotten Sons and Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch. That sounds completely lame, by the way, to go with a DQ finish there in that match. They didn't want to beat the Vikings, and so they had them lose by DQ. And when the match was over, they took a bow, and so that appears to be their send-off. Now new champions are going to be crowned in a fatal four-way on the next TakeOver show, which looks to be the Street Profits, Burch and Lorcan, Forgotten Sons, and the Undisputed Era for the tag team titles. It's now or never for the Street Profits. They need to stop jerking these guys around like they did with Enzo and Cass. They never won the tag titles in NXT either, or on the main roster. They got to stop jerking these guys around and put the belts on them. If they don't win them on that TakeOver show, then they're never going to. It just feels like they've come close and they've come close. And there is something to be said for building interest and building and building. Well, it's building to this. And if they don't pull the trigger now, it's going to be a missed opportunity. Also, Beth Phoenix is the newest addition to the NXT announce team. She replaced Percy Watson at the tapings this week. I don't know if this is a permanent change, but if it is, I don't have any particular opinion on it one way or the other. I didn't think Percy Watson added anything to the announce team. He was just a body in a suit. And I kind of feel the same way about Beth. You know, she's been fine, I guess, when I've heard her do commentary before, but nothing special. It would not at all surprise me to see them add a female voice to the announce booth when SmackDown moves to Fox, just to make sure they have, you know, female representation on the team. Adding Beth to the NXT booth could be a way to get her ready for that. I would think that she would be a candidate for that position. And that's just me talking out loud. That's not anything that I've heard or read reported somewhere or anything like that that they're planning on doing. But I do wonder if this Beth Phoenix addition to the NXT announce team is something of a dry run for her possibly being added to the announce team when SmackDown goes to Fox. Here's a quick Maven story that I read about this week from his appearance on the live show that Sam Roberts did at Caroline's on Broadway in New York City. This was back in March, and I'm not quite sure why this particular news website decided to run this now as a news item. But this was too good not to share, and I never heard this before. So Maven was a guest, as I said, on Sam's live show. He was there with Zack Ryder and Curt Hawkins and Hornswoggle, quite the lineup. And he talked about his big moment in the 2002 Royal Rumble match when he eliminated The Undertaker, one of the more memorable moments in Royal Rumble history. And it got a huge reaction. He said Undertaker was fine with helping him out that night and trying to make a new star. He said the plan was for him to be busted open during the match, after the elimination, when Undertaker just beat the shit out of him. I mean, my God, did he ever with that chair shot to the skull. Undertaker was a serial offender with that chair. Maven, Mr. Kennedy, You look at the chair shot he gave to Shawn Michaels towards the end of that Hell in a Cell match. This guy was brutal. So he said that in the wrestling business, if you want to get color, you take aspirin before your match because aspirin helps thin the blood, which I'm well aware of because for what I have, I have to take baby aspirin every morning. Well, Maven said that he's allergic to aspirin. So he's backstage with The Undertaker. It's about 90 minutes before they're set to go out to the ring. And Undertaker says to him, take a couple of baby aspirins to thin your blood out. And Maven says, well, I'm allergic. And Undertaker's response is, oh, well, let's drink some Jack. So they go off and they're drinking Jack Daniels before they go out there for the Royal Rumble match. And Maven says, I'm out there, finally. I'm not feeling a thing when Undertaker's kicking my ass and hitting me with chairs and shit. He goes, I don't feel anything because I'm two sheets to the wind. Meaning, you know, he was shit-faced. He said, I'm shocked as fuck that I actually hit the dropkick, but I'm glad that I did. Now, that's a hell of a story to have. I know Maven didn't have a very long career, but that is a story that not too many people, I think, would be able to share. You know, like, hey, I'm allergic to aspirin, so I sat with The Undertaker an hour before the Royal Rumble match in the back and drank whiskey to thin my blood. Shit, if that's the case, I think I may ditch the aspirin and just start drinking Jack every morning before I go to work. I watched the last of the Von Erich special from Viceland, and I'd say it was the second best one so far after the Bruiser Brody one. The Gino Hernandez one airs this week. I've already seen that one. I put that one third behind these two. Moolah is the last one. I haven't watched that one yet, but I have access to it from a friend, so I'll probably watch it this week. They've all been good, and the ratings for each one have increased with each airing, which hopefully bodes well for a second season. You know, one of the directors said that they've already shot about 75% of a seventh episode on the death of Dino Bravo, which would be a fascinating watch. I've talked about Bravo's death before on the podcast, but to see it play out on the screen or maybe even have some additional details added to what may or may not have happened, I think would be a must-watch. He also said they want to do episodes, if they do come back for a second season, on Adrian Adonis' death in that van accident. Actually, three wrestlers died, not just Adonis, in that car accident. He was one of them. They want to do one on Chris Benoit, which you can understand why. And they want to do one on the Brawl for All that WWE did back in 1998, which I guess could be interesting. I can't say that excites me too much. But anyway, hopefully it bodes well for a second season. I had some people ask me, you know, what did you think about this as compared to the Heroes of Wrestling? If I watch this one, am I going to learn anything new that I didn't already know from that documentary? I'm ashamed to say that I never watched the Heroes of World Class documentary. But shout out to Adam for hooking me up with a copy. I do plan to watch it soon. So I can't say that there is much in this special that you would not already know. I mean, Heroes of Wrestling, I think, is like a two-hour documentary or more. This is not even an hour. I'm almost sure you're not going to learn much in the way of new information watching this, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't watch and that it isn't worth your time, because I think it is. It does focus on Kevin Von Erich, even more so than just it being a general Von Erich documentary. Kevin, as the survivor, obviously, I mean, Kevin is heavily focused on here as the lone surviving member of the Von Erich men. He has two sons of his own now who wrestled at one of the Impact Slammiversary shows maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It was a one shot because they were in Texas. They were looking for some kind of a draw. They thought, well, we're in Texas, and so why not go to the Von Erichs, who were a draw so many years ago? And I remember Kevin even put the claw on somebody during that match. These days, he's living in Hawaii. I was on his Twitter. I was looking at some of the photos that he posts of the creatures down there that he finds, little geckos and lizards and all sorts of just life and creatures, the lakes, the waterfalls. It reminds me of when I was in Costa Rica. I'm jealous. I mean, it is beautiful. The property he owns there and him sitting up in the tree drinking pineapple juice and the backdrop behind him, it's like paradise. And he seems to be enjoying his life. He's in a good place. But you watch this, and what this guy has been through, all of the loss all of the tragedy that he has been through, it's a miracle that, you know, he didn't end up in a bad place himself. A lot of people would crack. A lot of people, you know, might just succumb to depression and horrible thoughts. And, you know, there was all this talk for years of the Von Erich curse. And Kevin Von Erich, at least, is someone who you could say, if there was a curse, broke the Von Erich curse, because he's in a good place now in his life. And they talked about, you know, how popular, how massively, insanely popular the Von Erichs were in Dallas back when World Class was hot. During that early to mid-80s period, there was no territory in the country, or maybe even the world, hotter than World Class Championship Wrestling. Fritz Von Erich. Fritz was a big name in the NWA as a wrestler, and in World Class, where he obviously took over and was running the promotion later on when he was retired or semi-retired. He had six sons, five of whom lived long enough, he lived long enough, Fritz did, to bury before he himself died of cancer. I think it was lung cancer in 1997. I think it might have been lung cancer that traveled to his brain. So he passed away in 97, and the documentary takes us through each of the Von Erich deaths, the highs of when the Von Erichs were popular, and then each of their deaths. The first one being Jack Jr. He was the youngest. He was only 6 years old when he died. He was electrocuted and fell face down and drowned in a puddle outside. David, he died in a hotel room in Japan from what was said to be, and what Kevin insists in the documentary, was acute enteritis, or he called it gastroenteritis. Now, the story over the years has changed a bit. You know, they've claimed that it was a kick during a match in Japan that ruptured his intestine, which is a lie because he died before he even wrestled his first match on that tour. So that couldn't have been true. Now, on this special, Kevin just says David was, he was throwing up right before he left for his trip, but his father insisted that he go, and he makes the trip, and so he went and flew to Japan. But he claims he was already sick before he left. Now, I know that Ric Flair and a lot of other wrestlers from that period, Flair is hardly the only one, are convinced that that was just the cover story for a drug overdose. I know Dave Meltzer years ago, and Meltzer actually lived in Texas. He was, I think, actually living in Texas during that period when World Class was so hot. He did a big write-up on the Von Erichs years ago, right after Kerry died. So this would have been sometime in 93. So we're talking 25-plus years. He did this huge feature on the Von Erich family. He noted in the Observer that David was out at Ribera Steakhouse the night before he passed away. He was doing a lot of drinking. A lot of drinking. And the next day, when he didn't come down to the lobby, one of the Japanese referees went to David's hotel room with Bruiser Brody. They may have even knocked down the door. And they found him dead. And it was Brody who flushed the drugs that they found down the toilet. So nobody would know about them. Nobody would see them. Nobody would suspect. And it was allegedly the same drug that his brother Michael, or Mike Von Erich, later overdosed on, this drug Placidil, which was a sleep medication of some kind. I think they used it to treat insomnia in some people. They don't even manufacture them anymore. They stopped in the late 90s in part because so many people were abusing them, and I guess they just came out with better, more effective drugs. So they don't even make that anymore. We had a Supreme Court justice who was addicted to them. So this was a big problem back then. Now, Kevin, in the documentary, he insists it was gastroenteritis, and he acknowledged people thought it was drugs. He said it was gastroenteritis, and we couldn't save him. And I get why he would want to stick to that story. But I believe it was probably a drug overdose. Nobody will know for sure. Nobody could ever know for sure. I believe there was a reporter, and I forgot his name, something Mushnick, I don't know if it was Irwin or Irv Mushnick, who many, many years ago, I believe, was asking about this, and the family had said they would provide him with either like a death certificate or an autopsy report just to kind of set the record straight once and for all. And then right before they were going to give it to him, they reneged, and they never gave it to him. It just, the whole thing sounds to me like they're covering up for what was probably a drug overdose, because that just doesn't sound as glamorous. So they came up with this other story, and it would not be the first time that Fritz or the family would come up with some kind of story or excuse. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't, to explain away something bad. And that's what I think probably happened in this instance. So Jack dies, then David dies. Kerry then wins the NWA world title from Ric Flair, only to drop it not even 3 weeks later because he had his own issues and he was said to be very unreliable because of those issues. They never planned on keeping the title on him for very long. It was more David died and it was this big event kind of in his honor, and they wanted to give Kerry and the family the big moment of him winning the championship, and he got it, and then they got that freaking belt off him as quickly as they could right after. After David's death, they talked about how Fritz pushed for a new Von Erich brother to be added on TV, Lance Von Erich. Now, Lance Von Erich, the person they had play the role, had no relation whatsoever to the Von Erich family. It was all pure storyline, and Kevin was dead set against the idea. He thought it was stupid. He thought the fans weren't going to buy it. It was going to hurt their credibility, and that's exactly what happened. Lance Von Erich was a total fail. And then the person who played Lance had a falling out with Fritz and jumped to a rival promotion. And Fritz, out of spite, went on TV and totally just killed kayfabe and revealed that Lance was not a real Von Erich. It was whatever, part of the story. It was faked or whatever. Just to get back at the guy. So Mike was next. Mike Von Erich, he never wanted to be a wrestler. He was not a particularly great athlete. But his father forced him into it after David's death, or pushed him into it, and he just wasn't built for it. He was too small. He took drugs to get bigger. He ended up suffering toxic shock syndrome, and he almost died. He recovered, kind of, but you could tell he wasn't quite right after that. He had no business getting back into the ring, but they put him into the ring anyway. And it was just a downward spiral. It was very sad to hear, again, you hear about his story. It was a downward spiral for him after that. He would get in trouble with the law. It was almost like you hear about people sometimes who have, they suffer some kind of a traumatic health episode. Maybe they have a stroke. Maybe it affects their brain in some way. They have some kind of traumatic brain injury. You might hear this with soldiers and people who come back from war zones who have suffered some kind of traumatic brain injury. And it changes their behavior. You know, it changes their personality. They're maybe they're more aggressive, or they're more withdrawn, or whatever the case may be. It almost sounds as though that may have been the case with Mike Von Erich, where he just wasn't the same person after he recovered from the whole toxic shock episode, got in trouble with the law, and killed himself by overdosing on Placidol. And that was reported in the news media at the time. That was the drug that he OD'd on. And he left two suicide notes, one in his car and one in his home, just 23 years old when he died. David was, I think, 25. Mike was only 23. Then came Chris. Chris committed suicide. He badly wanted to be a wrestler like his brothers. He looked up to Kerry in particular. He loved wrestling. He just wasn't cut out for it physically. He wasn't even allowed to play sports in school because he suffered from asthma. But Fritz, again, sort of pushed him into it. He created all of these phony amateur wrestling accomplishments to help build him up on TV and, you know, in the local media. And when he finally realized that this just wasn't going to work and he was not going to be able to be a wrestler, he shot himself in the head with a 9mm. Just 21 years old. So 25, 23, 21. And if that isn't depressing enough, then you get into the story of Kerry. Now, Kerry was older. I think he was about 30 when he died. But Kerry committed suicide, another suicide. In 1993, he had the motorcycle accident, which they did talk about years earlier. He lost his foot. Apparently, he was riding his motorcycle. He was way over the speed limit, wasn't even wearing any shoes, and rammed into the back of a police cruiser. His foot and ankle were all mangled. He had surgery. They kept it a secret. I don't think his foot was amputated in surgery right after the accident. I think what happened is he had surgery, he was recovering, but the ankle did not, I don't know, fuse properly, or just the recovery with the ankle was not working. It did not go well. And there was a follow-up procedure, and that's where they had to amputate the foot. And they kept it a secret. Some people knew. There was the story about the match he was in once, and his boot came off, and the people who saw it were just stunned into silence by what they saw. Wrestlers in the locker room would talk about how when Kerry would shower, he would always keep his boot on. I mean, that's going to... Look, I mean, that's going to make people think that something's up. So there were people who either suspected, people who flat out knew. Most people did not. If it was the age of today with the internet and social media, the moment that his boot popped off at that indie show, you know, it would have been all over Twitter. But back then, you could, you know, kind of keep things under wraps a lot easier than you can today. So a lot of people did not know. WWE knew. Vince McMahon knew long before they signed him to bring him in. There's stories about them playing games with World Class and calling athletic commissions to try to get certain shows shut down and telling them that performer, you know, shouldn't be allowed to perform if they're missing limbs and all this ridiculous stuff that went on in wrestling back then. But they didn't have any issue signing him in 1990, and they brought him in as the Texas Tornado, and he even had a very brief run with the Intercontinental title for a few months. But after that, he didn't do anything. They cut him loose in the summer of 92 because they just didn't want to have any part of him. He had drug problems. He had all sorts of problems. And they just said, you know what? We do not want to have anything to do with this. And they let him go. And he had big time drug problems to the point where he was probably going to go to jail. He had gotten busted. This was late 92, I think early 93. He got busted. And it looked like this time he was going to jail. And he did not want to go to jail. He knew it. He knew that's probably where he was headed. That's when he drove to his father's ranch, grabbed the gun, went off into the woods, and he shot himself in the chest. And then there's Kevin, the sole survivor. If this were a Survivor Series match, he would be the last brother standing. And after Kerry died, Kevin had this quote where he said, "I've always been the older brother, and now I'm not even a brother." If that isn't the saddest thing that you will hear all day, well, you must be having a really bad day, because that's pretty damn sad. And yet, when the special is over, it was kind of a happy ending, because you see Kevin and his kids and where he's living. I think he's got grandkids now. And the guy has gotten on with his life and seems to be loving life. And so it does end on a happy note. It's not all just sadness and tragedy. Kevin is obviously all over this documentary with, you know, the interview they did with him. They interviewed David Manning, who is a referee in World Class Championship Wrestling. Jim Cornette is interviewed. Dave Meltzer, whose office is just a total fire hazard. You should watch this alone just to get the shot of Meltzer sitting in his office with just papers strewn all over the place. So if you haven't watched it, I encourage you to do so. Even if you don't learn anything new about the story, you can go to the Viceland website and watch the full episode there. If you live outside the U.S., it may be region locked. If so, I don't know what to tell you. But I know here, at least, you can watch each episode on their website the day after it airs on TV. Let's get to some of your mailbag questions and wrap up here. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Dorian from North Carolina, I was sitting here listening to episode 597, and I heard you talk about plans for the storyline with Vince McMahon's brother, Rod. That never happened. And again, that was the angle where Vince would supposedly die in the limo explosion, and then his brother Rod would be brought in to basically be Bizarro Vince, right? The polar opposite of Vince McMahon, all nice and laid back. Court Bauer talked about the idea years ago on his podcast, so I just want to put some context here to what Dorian is talking about. Anyway, he says, it sounded a whole lot like that episode of Saved by the Bell, when Mr. Belding's brother, also named Rod, came to town to take over their history class. He was much cooler than his brother, and the kids took a liking to him more than Mr. Belding. I didn't even make that connection last week, but you're right. Right down to the name. Holy shit, now I have to wonder if they got the idea from Saved by the Bell in the first place. We could have had an angle borrowed from an episode of Saved by the Bell. Play itself out on WWE television with the McMahon family. Malcolm, in Mount Vernon, New York, on Impact's latest pay-per-view, there were two big Spanish fly spots. Phoenix almost crashed headfirst onto the apron, and Brian Cage suffered an injury that may force him to give up his belt. These cases, along with Will Ospreay's scare on the apron in Charlotte at WrestleMania, sparked a conversation with a friend who feels the move should be banned. Do you agree? I am not a fan of banning moves. I think doing it on the floor or doing it off the ramp is insanely stupid and unnecessary and doesn't add anything to the match. But if I am a promoter or if I am a booker, and I see someone using the move, you know, more and more and very, not that the move is not dangerous just off the top rope as normal, but in really like ultra dangerous situations like that, then I would just pull them aside and just say, look, tone it down a little bit. You know, if you're going to do the move in the ring, keep it inside, don't do it outside. I wouldn't say you are not allowed to do this anymore unless I just really felt like they were ignoring me. And they were being a danger to themselves or a danger to other people that they're working with. But I just, in general, as a general rule, I'm not really a fan of arbitrarily banning moves. Stuart, in Glasgow, I met The Undertaker and Mick Foley on Wednesday in Glasgow, which was obviously amazing. But as I was leaving the venue and walking to the train, I heard Hall & Oates blasting, which obviously made me think of you due to your love of both wrestling and Hall & Oates. Well, I like one and I love the other, and I'll let you figure out which is which. But anyway, during the show, Foley talked about his boiler room brawl with The Undertaker, and he mentioned something I'd never known before. He spoke about how it almost never happened because The Undertaker had not signed his new WWE contract, and Foley was of the belief that he might have jumped to WCW in 1996. I wonder if you had heard this story before. What do you think The Undertaker would have looked like in WCW during the early formation of the NWO, and how might he have changed the Monday Night War? I had not heard that story before. The only story I heard was put out years ago by Kevin Nash, who claimed that they came close to getting Undertaker one time, and it may have been 98. It definitely was not 96. But Eric Bischoff has since come out and claimed that that is not true. There was never one meaningful conversation with The Undertaker about coming to WCW, according to Eric Bischoff. So that's the first I'm hearing of that story that you just mentioned, even being a possibility as early as 1996. You know, that, frankly, that might be a better question to ask Bruce Pritchard, if we trust that everybody is telling the truth here, which, it's wrestling, so you have to take everything you hear with a grain of salt. Everybody has their own agenda. I'll tell you this much, though. Had he gone to WCW, he could not have been The Undertaker. So I think he would have come to WCW looking like he did when he was the American Badass in 2000. And I think losing Undertaker would have been a devastating blow for Vince McMahon because he was like the heart and soul of that company. So I think Vince would have looked at him leaving as a betrayal on the level of a Randy Savage leaving. You know, I mean, Undertaker is Vince McMahon's greatest creation. And he was a locker room leader. I mean, losing him would not have lost them the Monday Night War. I don't think it would have swung the war the other way. But it would have hurt. You know, but Undertaker was not a megastar on the level of a Hulk Hogan or a Steve Austin. He did not move the needle like those guys did. So as long as they would have stayed the course with Stone Cold and built him up and built up new stars like The Rock and other people, I don't think the outcome would have been all that different. Maybe it would have taken a little bit longer, but I really don't think it would have been all that different. It would have hurt for a while, no doubt, but WCW still would have gone under because they were just mismanaged into oblivion. And bringing in The Undertaker, and not even as The Undertaker, but bringing him in as Mark Calloway or Mean Mark was not going to change that. I do think they would have put him in the NWO because other than Hogan, who was more WWE than The Undertaker at the time? And that was why the NWO worked so well. And I think over time, the group would have fractured the way that it did. And it would have been The Undertaker leading his own, you know, wing of the NWO. His ministry would have looked very different in WCW than it looked in WWE. Mike, in Detroit, I recently watched the Please Don't Die Joey Janela documentary as well as a Vice doc on death matches, and it heightened my hatred for extreme hardcore wrestling. The idea of death matches in overly violent spots like wood skewers, light tubes, or even weapons that maim do nothing but turn me off. Am I the only one? Guys like Jimmy Havoc, Sammy Callahan, and others do them like nothing but hurt the sport, in my opinion. And with the signing of guys like Jimmy Havoc to AEW, I really hope they don't endorse those types of matches. What do you think? Not to go full Cornette, but does this stuff really have a place? Yeah, of course it does. It has a place. Obviously it does. I mean, there's a lot of people who enjoy it, and there are guys who have created big names and careers for themselves by doing hardcore matches. Case in point, there's a guy by the name of Mick Foley. You might have heard of him before. There's a guy by the name of Terry Funk. You may have heard of him too. Now, Terry Funk was a traditional wrestler, traditional heel. But as he got older, and he was more limited maybe in what he could do, he started doing death matches and barbed wire matches and hardcore matches and C4 matches in Japan and FMW and ECW. He was ripping his body to shreds. Mick Foley, even more so. Same thing. C4, barbed wire, a lot of crazy shit. And maybe they wouldn't have been, Funk would have been, but maybe Foley, I can almost guarantee you that Foley would not have become as big as he did. I mean, even when he made it, even when he was already in WWE, the Hell in a Cell stuff, look at the abuse he took in that match. You talk about people trying to maim themselves. The guy almost single-handedly committed suicide in that match. And obviously there's an audience for it. I'm not going to say there isn't. Are you wrong in feeling, you know, a hatred for matches like that? No, and I don't like them either. I never understood it. When I watch some of these indie promotions, or I watch some of the stuff that they've done in the past in FMW in Japan, CZW, some of the crazy shit with light tubes, staple guns, and explosives, and setting people on fire, and like you said, wood skewers, and I don't like that. That's not my thing. It might be someone else's thing. I don't begrudge them for it. I don't watch that stuff. Because that, to me, is not wrestling. I don't know what that is. But I'm fine with like a hardcore match with weapons and some blood and stuff. But I guess there's just a line that you cross that it's just not my thing. And the things that you just mentioned, especially the light tube stuff and anything with glass, like, it's just stupid. You just cross the line into stupidity when you do that sort of thing, because what are you gaining from this? I don't understand. What are you gaining from it? Especially when you're putting yourself through that kind of abuse in front of 50 people in a backyard somewhere. I don't get it. Jad from London, England. My question concerns Twitter. A lot of wrestlers today use it to inform us that we are marks, that our opinions don't mean shit, and that we should just get behind the product no matter what they put out. But what if Twitter was around 30 years ago? Given how coked up some of the talent was back then, I can imagine following them on Twitter would have been hilarious. If Twitter existed in the 80s, which wrestler would you have most liked to follow? Oh my God, are you kidding me? All of them. Imagine the Macho Man on Twitter. Or the Ultimate Warrior. Especially when they're still, you know, at the building after a long marathon taping. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. They're sitting around trying to film all these local market promos. Promo after promo. They're tired. They're sore. They're doing God knows what. Everybody else has gone home. They're just sitting around the dressing room. Oh, the trouble these guys would get into. Jim Neidhart on Twitter. David Schultz. I would follow all of them. But it would also expose the business. It would expose wrestling in a way that I think would have just killed the mystique much earlier than it did. So I'm actually really happy Twitter was not around back then. I'm elated. As a wrestling fan, I'm just ecstatic that Twitter was not around back then. Because I really think, especially as a young kid, not too young to not be on social media, if it existed back then, it would have totally just killed wrestling for me at a young age. When you're still impressionable and those characters and those feuds, you know, you still really buy into it. It would have been horrible in that regard, but it would have been supremely entertaining with some of these personalities to have had, you know, access to Twitter and Facebook at their fingertips at any given moment from wherever they would have been, you know. Or, yeah, but there's a flip side to it too. I was thinking about this. There's also like a more serious side to it, in that you hear a lot from guys who, especially back then, they say, man, the schedule was so brutal and you're away from your family so much. And so you drink and you do drugs. I mean, there are just some people who are going to be predisposed to that anyway, who are just party guys or troublemakers who are going to be doing bad shit. But you had people who maybe got into stuff they shouldn't have gotten into because they were bored and because they felt lonely. And they were depressed. They were in their hotel room all by themselves. And there's no outlet for them. So what if Twitter existed back then? And what if Instagram existed back then and Facebook? And instead of just sitting in their hotel room being lonely and depressed, what if they had social media as an outlet where they can actually interact with people? You know, and they can post what they were feeling and what they were thinking and what they're doing. And they can, you know, interact and talk to their kids and talk to their family and FaceTime and all the stuff that guys now take for granted. I wonder how many of those guys maybe would still be alive today. I mean, it sounds kind of ridiculous. Like, you know, could Twitter have saved lives back then? And it's not just Twitter. I mean, just technology in general, the way that it's evolved. I think that there's, you know, probably a decent number of guys who might still be around today, if they had the outlet to social media back then like they do today. So, I mean, there's different ways to look at it. I was just thinking about that after I got the question. And I think it goes both ways. So keep sending in those questions. You can email me always at thesolomonster@gmail.com. I will continue to plug the fact that we are going to be live on YouTube for episode 600. Of the Sound Off, special date, Friday, May 17th at 9 p.m. Eastern, taking your phone calls. So now would be a great time to sub to the YouTube channel if you are not already a subscriber, youtube.com/TheSolomonster. You'll see the logo for the official channel. We are getting closer to 50,000 subs, so you can help me get there. Go ahead and subscribe right now. But first, we got to get through episode 599. Next weekend is Mother's Day weekend. I have a couple of different things going on. I'm hoping the show is, you know, up at a normal time, normal date next week. It is possible that it could be an abbreviated show, or maybe it goes up a day early. I'm not quite sure what I'm doing yet, but there will be an episode 599, and then 600 will follow that Friday. So that is the plan right now. That is the schedule. Until next time, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great Cinco de Mayo, and a great rest of your week. And I will see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend on the road to 600. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
EC3 lost to Tyler Breeze.
I tweeted, that sounds like something you would put on the tombstone of your career.
They never should have called him up in the first place if they had no plans for him. I haven't seen a career fade this fast since Jussie Smollett.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/TheSolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
This is the 1840 Theater Hounslow. Calling next at Clapham Junction.
Junction! Woman say, Junction! Please mind the gap because it's massive, massive! Incredible fanta! We got the new flavor! This announcement.
Sugar. Now available in the UK by popular demand. Grab a bottle and make your mouth funner. Big up our soft drink massive. General leave it under the Fanta crew.
This is the 1840 Theatre Hounslow. Calling next at Clapham Junction.
Junction! What was that? Junction! Please mind the gap because it's massive, massive! Incredible Fanta! We got the new flavor! This announcement was brought to you by the new Fanta Grape Zero Sugar. Now available in the UK by popular demand. Grab a bottle and make your mouth funner. Big up our soft drink massive. General leave it under the Fanta crew.